And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3796 of the Survival Podcast. It is a Monday, and as is typical on a Monday, you have just me, just Jack Show, but kind of sort of not. Today's show is new things the TSP community is growing in 2026. And so what we're talking about is new plant varieties, different seeds to start, things like that. Baker Creek will feature pretty heavily today. I think that's everybody's crack dealer with new things and finding odd things and unique things from all around the world. But there's a lot of other companies out there selling great stuff. And even though there's a lot of links in today's show notes, when you get over to the audio side on my blog at thesurvivalpodcast.com, you don't need to feel obligated to use any of the links I gave you today in any way. I gave you what I could find or what the person participating gave me, because this was a lot of work. This is one of those shows you do like, I know what I'll do. I'll just make a post on Facebook and say, hey, tell me the new stuff you're growing this year, and I'll make a big list and do a show. And that's exactly what I did. It's exactly how it worked, and it's never easy when you do that. Because you end up with this, you know, laundry list of stuff like I've got here today. For those on the video, you can see that several pages of text, because it's the only way I could do this and try to cover everything. Then you got to kind of pare it down and make links and make this giant blog post with all this stuff in it. So that's why the show's at 1 today instead of noon. Usually a Monday show starts at noon, but just getting all of this done took some time, but it was worth it. And so what I mean by it's not really just Jack, there was over 100 people that responded to that Facebook post. Now, not everybody made the cut. It wasn't really a judgment either of who was got the best stuff or the worst. Like, a lot of people said the same stuff, right? So if you said the same stuff and somebody came before you, then I probably didn't repeat it with you. Or some of the stuff was things that, like, you know, everybody grows that or what, like I grow mint or whatever without a specific variety. So those probably got left behind too, just because it's going to be a long show today, even with that trimming down. And I've just got a ton of stuff, and shows like this are fun. I have people that say they wait every year for this show or some version thereof because it inspires them to try new things. And I actually have a fairly small list of new things I'm growing this year. Usually I do this show, it's like, here's 12 or 15 things that I'm personally growing. This year I only have 5 brand new things that I've never grown before. But there's a reason for that, and that is years and years, in fact decades, of always growing, you know, a handful of new things every year. You know, and I'm in my 50s now. If I hadn't figured out the stuff that really does really well for me that I can depend on yet, that would probably be bad, right? That would mean that I'm not really getting anywhere. So I just have less need of finding new stuff now, and I've tried hundreds of plant varieties and plant types. So with that in mind, I reached out to the audience. You guys did a great job. Thank you. Don't think I'm complaining when I said how long it took me to put it together. That's what's going to make it awesome today. Before we do that, though, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor day number one today, nothing to do about gardening really at all, other than I guess you could use some technology in your gardening. But it's Start 9 Private Servers. This is where you can take back your privacy and control of your own data. When you hear about cloud-based services, it sounds like there's a cloud up there. There's no cloud. It's just somebody else's computer, which means somebody else can cut off your access or your data can be stolen from other locations. With Start 9, you can do all the cool things with one little box that you install in your home and install some applications on your cell phone and then configure them, and you're off to the races. You can set up a Bitcoin node. You can set up a Lightning node and be your own bank. You can set up BTC Pay server and then take payments in Bitcoin on your website directly to your wallet and your node with no third party. You can have end-to-end encrypted communications with only the people that you let into your system. There's all kinds of applications. I think a lot of people think this is just a Bitcoin tool. That's only one of the things it does. And I'm going to bet you there's a lot of people out there running Start 9 that aren't running a Bitcoin node. It's not their thing. They're using it for the other great technology that's available. Check them out today at start9.com. Remember, discount is 9% for MSB members, and you can stack that with a fold card for more discount and stack sats when you buy it. So check them out today. Start 9, Sovereign Computing. Next up today, little bit closer to gardening, I guess, because it's more hands-on, but KnifeKits.com. These guys are like the original Survival Podcast sponsor, man. They've been around as long as anybody. I would say at this point they are probably the longest continuous running sponsor that we have, and they might be the longest continuously running sponsor any podcast has ever had. We first brought them to you in early, like what would have been February of 2009, and it's 2026. That means these guys, give them another couple of years, and they're going to be a freaking 20-year sponsor if they don't go anywhere. So check them out today, KnifeKits.com, a company that does what it says and says what it does, all the things you need to do to make your own knives from kits. Or you can buy individual material. You can buy, you know, stuff to forge your own knives, do your own work, or you can buy the kits. It's up to you. And they have a lot of other cool stuff as well. With that, I want to get on into it today. And I want to say that I'm going to pull up some things for those of you on the video. But if you're not on video today, it really shouldn't be that big a deal that you're not. I'm going to try not to rely on the video stuff. And I'm going to try to make sure that I don't get confused and be talking about one thing and have another thing on the screen. I'm going to try to remember to flip back and forth. It gets a little overwhelming when you're by yourself and you're doing shows this big. But again, what I did is I just reached out. I just reached out and said, hey, if you're going to be growing anything new this year, tell me what it is. And if you have a source of plants or seeds or whatever, give me a link. Now, that was the entire post. And with that, like I said, more than 100 people responded. And then there was also some good side discussion with people exchanging ideas, techniques. So it's just one of those really great community built things. But I'm just going to go through all of the ones that I pulled out and I made, you know, short versions thereof and kind of give you my thoughts on some of the things people are growing and what you might do with them. And some of them are just, I included them because they were fun and you don't necessarily get a huge insight. And that's kind of the first one. Zach said, I'm going to grow blackberries, strawberries, and blueberries, raise beds with my 5-year-old. She's going to eat them all. Hey, that's great, Zach. And, I think it's a really great way. I haven't done a show on gardening with kids for a very long time, and maybe I should again. I think there's a lot of things you can get kids to eat and get excited about eating them if they take part in growing them. And, you know, he says strawberries and blueberries and blackberries. Strawberries, to me, I've always referred to those as garden pepperoni. I know that sounds crazy. Hear me out. Hear me out on the garden pepperoni thing. In my experience anyway, going all the way back to when I was a kid, then being a father and having a kid with friends and now having grandchildren, the pizza topping that was universally approved of by the most kids, other than plain cheese, okay, pepperoni. I met very few people, let alone kids in my life, that didn't like pepperoni. I'm going to say the same thing about strawberries. I have not met many kids, no matter how much they're into gooey, cakey, crap shit, that if they're offered fresh strawberries, won't give them a try. So it's a great entry point. Just remember for Zach and anybody else doing this, when you think about things like blackberries, strawberries, blueberries, the production in your first year often isn't that great. So maybe put in some fast producing things as well to keep the kids excited. Justin says he's going to grow some avocados. Now, Justin didn't say where he is, but I'm sure a lot of you folks are thinking avocado. I guess you better be in the tropics. And what I found for you guys on this one is just a whole bunch of what are considered cold hardy avocados. Now, this does not mean that you're going to be able to grow these things where it goes down really low temperature and stays there long term. However, there are some varieties of avocado that will survive brief dips down into the teens. Most of them are not the avocados that you're typically thinking of when you go to the grocery store, your great big old Haas avocados and things like that, the ones we make guacamole out of. But there's some pretty, like, avocados are one of the places we haven't even really begun to scratch the surface on all of the cool options that there are for avocados. So that's what I've got for you on this one. I'd love to hear from anybody in this audience. Whether right now in the live chat or by email to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, who has successfully grown avocados not only in the United States, but not in the very southern tip of California or the southern tip of Florida. Somebody that's done it where it actually does get at least frosty, if not occasional freezes. I think that would be a really interesting thing. Because that's one of the things, like, if you ask me, what would I like to grow that I can't really grow in my climate due to, you know, limitations of winter anyway? Most people would think I'd say citrus, you know, satsumas and oranges and lemons or limes or, you know, kefir lime or Meyer lemon or like, and it'd be all great. But I honestly don't eat that much citrus. In fact, the one thing I have thought about getting this year is a kefir lime tree in a pot to use the leaves in cooking more than anything else. But the reality is avocado. Avocado is one of the healthiest plant-based fats in the world. It's incredibly nutrient dense because of that. And it'd be fantastic to find something that we can keep alive here without putting it on life support and taking heroic measures. Technically, you can grow anything anywhere. But what do you have to do to get it done is kind of where I'm at with that. Then next up, from Connie, who is in Yonge County, Texas, she says she's going to be growing a pepper, a hot pepper called Natapino. Natapino, which is a pepper, a jalapeno pepper variety that purports anyway to be very low heat. Now, one of the things I noticed when I was, I kind of dug through these things so that I could talk to you about them a bit. And on the page on and this is a rareseeds.com, which is Baker Creek. There's, you know, they put their reviews up. And one thing I like about Baker Creek is they don't censor the reviews. If the bad reviews go, good reviews go, et cetera. Well, there was one person that said their peppers were actually quite small and extremely hot, as hot or hotter than any other pepper jalapeno pepper anyway they've ever tried. Now, I wanted to point something out about that. That's probably the plant was under stress. And one of the things you need to know about growing hot peppers, and this can be used for good or evil depending on how you apply it, peppers that are under stress, that are hot peppers, tend to produce smaller peppers and more capsaicin. So there could be a variety of reasons that her plants were under stress. Perhaps she was container growing them in too small a container. Perhaps she gave them not enough nutrient, not enough, who knows? But that is most likely the case, because most of the people that I know that have grown this pepper have said it delivers exactly what it's promised. Great big hand-sized jalapenos that are not sweet peppers with jalapeno flavor. They are a hot pepper. They're just way toned down. I have thought about growing these. I'm going to try something else this year. But I like to actually hybridize peppers intentionally. And this would be an interesting one to think about doing, except it is already like an F1 hybrid. So you would really need to prove it out first over about 7 generations to stabilize it before you start playing with it again. And I don't know that I have that in me with an already hybridized jalapeno. So I'm going to be trying something else this year. I'll tell you about it at the end. She also said that she's going to be trying to grow sea berry, which I think is a noble effort. It didn't work here very well for me when I tried growing it here. But that's probably more because of how rough my land is than the climate itself. And so the link I have for you is to a company called One Green World for Seaberry, because they have the most variety of any single source that I could find for you. Now, let's talk a little bit about Seaberry. Seaberry is also known as sea buckthorn. And they tend to call this the citrus of cold climates. So earlier we were talking about citrus. That's because it's a very high in vitamin C. Ounce for ounce, the juice from sea berry has way more actual vitamin C than oranges. And they're quite delicious, actually. There's a lot of different ways you can prepare them and use them. The only time I've ever actually tried them is up in Vermont at Ben Falk's farm, and they were really, really delicious. But one of the things you definitely need to know about these before you add them to your property, The main name that people use for them instead of sea berry is sea buckthorn. And boy, howdy, do they have some buckthorn. These guys are quite thorny, and they are definitely the kind of thorny that you probably would prefer not to deal with unless you had them where you want them, as you want them, the way that you want them. So what I've noticed is that Ben grows them in rows, and the way he grows them in rows in his little swale systems, there's really no place for them to spread out to the front or back. So he'll grow an entire row of nothing but this, maybe some other stuff gilded in. But that row itself is limited to nothing but sea buckthorn mostly. If there's anything else, it's like low down, like some herbs or stuff like that. And what that allows him to do is you're not trying to force your way in between them to get to like a grape or something like that. Yeah. Which is great. And then since you have kind of this row, then you have open grass that can be mowed, whether it's done by grazing sheep, which is what he does, or actual mowing or scything or something like that. That way they don't spread with suckers because they can become an impassable thorn clump in some climates. That's probably not going to happen to Connie in Texas. They're not going to be that aggressive growing here. They are a very northern, extremely cold hardy plant and something we talked about quite a bit in the past. Next up today, though, is a plant that came in from Chris, who said he's going to be growing Jabotica. I'm going to try to say this, Jabotica, and strawberries, both from Home Depot. I found a link for you guys on the Jabotica, if that's how you say it, with a discussion about growing them in cooler climates and the mixed results that people have had and what they've had to do there. He did not say where he's from. The fact that it's being sold at Home Depot probably means he's in like a zone 9. The consensus on people that have grown these in the States is they suffer even in 9B. So like 9A and higher, they're fine. 9B, you can do it. And below that, you're talking in a pot, moved in and out. But it's a really interesting tree. And it's weather only as to why I haven't tried growing them here. It's also called a tree grape. I've seen these around before, but they actually fruit straight off the trunk of the tree. So it looks almost alien. It looks like something you'd see like in an episode of Star Trek or something like that before it went woke and sucked anyway. And so you have this trunk of the tree and all these marble looking balls about the size of grapes coming straight off the primary and secondary trunks of the tree. And so that is a really cool thing. It's certainly something I would like to grow. I've never tried it. In my research, it turns out most people who have tried muscadine grape anyway tend to say that it actually tastes quite similar to muscadine grapes. And so I think that might be give you an idea of whether or not you want to do it, because I've always said that if you have something and it won't do well for you, but something a lot like it will, grow the thing that wants to grow. So if you really like muscadine grapes, then you would like this thing. And if you live way in the south, like southern tip of Florida, southern tip of Texas, southern tip of, you know, Arizona, California, then maybe this works. Anywhere else, you probably can find a really great muscadine that's going to love your climate. So I would say that for those that don't live in the area where this is going to be relatively easy to do. Next, Daniel said, I'll be focusing on aromatic flowers this year. That's something we don't do enough of. I try to do a lot of that every year. I grow safflower, zinnias, cosmos, all types of flowers, marigold, both marigold, pot marigold, and marigold tagastes, marigolds like you see at, you know, Home Depot and Lowe's and Walmart and flats. I grow all of that stuff because it has so much of an attraction for pollinators and repellent of pets, habitat diversity, and it's just a great way to occupy all the little nooks and crannies where you're not going to grow a productive plant. And you can either have edible flowers, medicinal flowers, herbs that happen to have flowers, or just beauty. And all of those things are incredibly valuable. So I think that's a good decision there. But he says he's also going to be trying to grow butterfly pea and purple tomatillo and mullein. And all of those are from Baker Creek. I wanted to share this one with you. And I don't think I actually ordered any seeds from Baker Creek when I put my order in, and I'm a little bit disappointed in myself. I want to try this as well. This butterfly pea flour is what they're called. There's quite a few varieties. I may go ahead and order some today and order several different varieties and see if maybe one of them is easier to grow here. I've heard from a lot of people about how cool they are, and I've heard from a lot of people who tried to grow them and said, yeah, but I didn't get any of the real results I was looking for. I didn't get great results with them. They're kind of finicky or hard to grow. So that, again, is always situational to the climate type that you're in versus what you're trying to grow. But let me tell you what makes them cool. But first of all, the blue color of them is just absolutely stunningly gorgeous. There's just not many things out there that look quite like these butterfly pea plants, right? And I'm going to go through some of the images here of them for you to get an idea of the blue. It is really a gorgeous, like, blue. I want to say, all right, guys, I have no idea where I was when I got cut off. I think that I was talking about the butterfly flowers, and I'm just going to kind of restart those. So if there's some redundancy here, I apologize for that. For the audio side, I'll take care of it when I do the editing. But no one nukes me or anything like that. It was a connection that failed on the computer and on the audio-video side of things on my end. So it's my fault that it happened. Anyway, the butterfly pea, the color is this deep, gorgeous blue. And what I was trying to say anyway is that this color looks very similar to the color of blue that my Dodge Challenger is. They call it Indiegogo blue. And when you make a tea from it that's supposed to be quite delicious, you make this deep blue tea. But like, this is like the magic thing the kids would love. You put a couple drops of lemon juice in it and the blue turns pink. How cool is that? So tons of people have told me they've tried to grow this one. No one that I've talked to yet has said, and I've had good results. The other side of it, I haven't talked to a ton of people. It's more like seeing people discuss it online, and people who have bad results tend to be more vocal than people that have good results. So your mileage may vary, but I'm thinking about getting two or three varieties of these this year and then trying to grow all of them and see if maybe I can find a variety that will do better for my climate type than otherwise. He also mentions purple tomatillo. I'm not going to bring those up, but I'll just say I love tomatillos. And there's a lot of varieties of tomatillos. And the link that I have for you today gives you varieties of tomatillos you may have never even considered growing before. Then Billy said he's going to be growing jelly melon. And very specifically, the African horned Kiwano jelly melon, and this looks pretty cool. I don't know that I'll grow this, but it's definitely one of those things that, you know, you can see why somebody might want to. These jelly melons, you see these a lot in your nicer grocery stores with your more adventurous produce sections. They kind of have like a spiny horn, and then it's like a jelly with a bunch of seeds on the inside of them. They looks like something more like a cactus than anything else to me. I've never grown these, but they are supposed to have like taste like jelly straight out of the thing. And I don't know, man. That's not my thing, but it's certainly something that is worth looking into. And if you're in the right climate for them, where they do really well, and if you are in the right market with them as well, these might be a real slayer at things like your farmers markets. So I definitely wanted to make sure I included those. And again, just because it's not my cup of tea doesn't mean that it might not be something that you might not really enjoy yourself. And just because I don't like something doesn't mean I need to tell you that you shouldn't grow it or something like that. That's just dumb. That just doesn't make a lot of sense there, does it? All right, so then the next one that I have is Cheryl. And Cheryl says she's going to be doing a cover crop of buckwheat, cowpea, and sweet potato. Cheryl has 20 beds on a new property and not enough time to weed them or plant them properly for this year. So instead of letting them become overwhelmed, she's going to take that trio, buckwheat, calathea, and sweet potato, and cover crop all the beds that she's not actually growing in this year. I think that's fantastic. I really do. I think that is an incredibly smart decision. It is the case that we tend to not cover crop, even those of us who do in home garden situations, we tend to not cover crop anywhere near as much in summer as we do in winter. And the reason is pretty obvious. Most of our gardens lay mostly fallow in the winter. Not all of you guys, but certainly the majority of people. Kind of like as you come into fall and things start to die, maybe you have some winter plants that hang on longer, like, you know, some broccoli or something. But eventually you're like, I'm kind of done. I'm kind of done. And I'll get all my starts and all in February. And then I'll put my plants out in late March, early April, and I'll do it all over again. I'll have a break. So it ends up being really easy to cover crop. So most of us that do even any kind of what we really think of as cover cropping in summer, unless we're establishing a new bed where it just needs it to get established, we're doing more of an intercropping. Like I was talking about, you know, mixing sunflower and zinnia and cosmos and safflower in with your existing vegetable production. But summer cover cropping can be extremely productive. And 20 beds of buckwheat, if you got bees, man, that is fantastic. And if you don't keep your own bees, if there's any bees in your area, they're going to be all over the place. I wanted to give one bit of advice for Cheryl on this, but it probably won't matter. She's in a great position here. Your buckwheat is going to move to full production within 6 weeks of being planted once it's warm out. After that, if you don't cut it so that it comes back, it's going to tend to get a little bit sick, and the cowpea is going to completely take over. And at the same time, your sweet potato is going to completely take over. So that's fine. And the nice thing about this cover crop is this is actually a productive cover crop. Cowpea is a completely acceptable form of food, right? For us, ourselves, if we want to do it. If you have chickens, ducks, geese, right? They love these things if you pick them more of what we would think of is a green bean level. So you can pick them and throw them to them, and they will eat the crap out of them. Chickens love green pod, black-eyed peas, cowpeas, etc. I mean, just absolutely will devour them. Once they get dry and hard, which is what you want for storage or for saving seed to plant again, they more need to be ground. I haven't seen them eat a lot of them. I've thrown a bunch of them at the ducks, and they'll look at them, and they peck one or two, and they're like, nah, that's not really my thing, and they move on with their life. But so there's utility there beyond the cover crop, but it's definitely worth considering if you cannot plant beds this summer that you have available because you just don't have the time to dedicate, you're just ramping up your homestead, whatever, cover crop them. Cover crop them, because otherwise you're going to grow a lot of things that you don't want to grow. If you don't put something in the spot, nature abhorring a vacuum will put something in the spot for you. All right, next up, let's talk about this one from Second Light Farm. Well, I love Second Light Farm. He's a great dude. I know he's here. I saw him in the chat earlier. He said, super hot peppers. He saw some selling for up to $30 a pound at farmers markets last year. These include things like scorpion, habaneros, and bird's eye. Bird's eye, he said, is his favorite pepper to grow. But the link he gave wasn't for bird's eye peppers, though I do have a link for you guys for bird's eye peppers. I wanted to show you, though, the link for what he put up with his comment. This is a hot Caribbean blend of peppers, and it's just basically a significant variety of habaneros, yellows, reds, chocolates, peach, that type of thing. So if you want to just like grow a bunch of different really hot peppers, that blend would be really good. Again, he also mentioned he likes bird's eye peppers. I like to grow bird's eye peppers too. I think bird's eye pepper, because they're small, I think perhaps are one of the more underrated peppers out there. These things look like little bitty berries. I mean, they're small. They're about, if you're familiar with a currant, they're about the size of a currant or a currant tomato. If you've never seen a currant, but you've seen a currant tomato, they are hot. They are hot. They are not the kind of pepper that you want to slice up a bunch of them and use them. They are for the purpose of making things spicy, and they do a damn good job of it. They also are, hot peppers in general are pretty hardy as it is, but these things are really hardy. And they are also very ornamental. When they start to turn color, you've got all these green and red berries all over a fairly sizable bush, and they have a little bit like of a darker green, smaller leaf form factor than your peppers. You think of like bell peppers or cow horns or jalapenos or something like that. So they're actually a really cool pepper to grow, to work with. And they are also, and this is what makes them so hardy. Nobody developed this pepper. Well, maybe somebody did. Maybe somebody many eons ago, in early agriculture in the New World that we think of as North of South America, some indigenous people maybe played around with selecting which ones to throw seeds here or there. But basically, this is a wild plant. And it's become very well loved in Thailand. They grow the hell out of these things in Thailand. But if you go to certain parts of Central America, you will find bushes of this stuff that's 5-6 foot tall, just growing out in the wild in fairly arid climates as well. They're not a desert plant, but that, kind of dry, arid, but enough rain that if roots get down, it can survive type of climate, like a Mediterranean, almost similar type climate. They do really, really well in, and they're just fantastic. Second Light, so there's a huge online community of super hot pepper lovers. They're always looking for new places to buy them. So that's going to be what I'm going to be trying this year. That's cool, man. That really is. And it is one of those things that has an almost cult-like thing to it. People want to find the hottest one, but they also get into like, well, this one has a peach undertone, or this one's really fruity and things like that. Me, myself, I'll grow a little bit of super hot. But then I'm going to use it in cooking where I'm using a very small amount of it. That small amount gets a magnified effect. More, I like to grow peppers that are in the range of like jalapeno up to Fresno and Serrano. That's kind of my happy zone. I like that amount of heat. I can use a lot of that in my cooking without, blowing my brains out or making no one else in my home able to eat it. CJ says, and I don't have any links on this one, but coffee. I find this really interesting. There was a time in my life, and we'll get to vanilla later because someone else said that. There was a time in my life where I had this idea. I wanted to put in a huge greenhouse, something more of like a hard structure, glass front, lean-to, maybe even Wolfadius. What do they call those in-ground greenhouses? I can't remember the name they use for them now that somebody made up. But something like that, maybe some geothermal. And I wanted to grow two things, coffee and vanilla. And then I wanted to make a deal. I just knew there was no real money in it. But he's kind of wanted to do it out of ego, right? I want to make a deal with a Texas brewery to do a small batch run once a year of like the big bottles, the ones that are like Chimay comes in like a champagne bottle, of a coffee vanilla stout with all the ingredients from Texas, because malted barley and all, we can do that. We can make the rest of that work. We can find a source of it. And to do something like that and be able to say the coffee and the vanilla were grown in Texas. And then I looked at what it takes. It takes quite a bit. But coffee is doable in a greenhouse glasshouse situation. A certain reasonable amount can be produced. And it can work. This is what you need to know about coffee arabica, though, which is a coffee that we drink, right? It's not a bush at all. It's a tree. It's a big tree. Now, the reason you see these videos of Mr. Juan Valdez in his burrow and they're picking the beans and they're standing and they're picking it like it's a bush, they prune the coffee to keep it short and they train it like that. So for you to be able to pull that off, you need to learn about pruning and the right form to get berries when the plant isn't that big. It's not hard. Billions of people, I guess, across the globe do it every year because they produce coffee pretty much anywhere it'll grow because it's such a commodity crop. But if you're going to be doing that, you're going to need to learn how to do that. And the first time I ever saw a full-size coffee tree, even though I spent a lot of my time in Central America when I was a young man, all the coffee I saw was pruned. And I probably wouldn't even have noticed, unless somebody pointed it out to me, a much bigger coffee tree. But the Fort Worth Botanical Gardens has this acre and a half glass house that is probably 40 foot tall inside it, at least 40, probably 40 on the edges and higher, probably closer to 60 at the apex. And they have all sorts of tropical plants and trees in there. And they do a really cool butterfly thing every spring where they bring all these butterflies in and you can go in there and have them land on you and stuff. And they have, among other really cool things, like they have an actual allspice, a pimento tree. That's pretty cool. When you grab a leaf off of a pimento tree, that allspice smell you get from allspice, it's like 100 times more from the leaf. But they have a coffee tree. And that coffee tree is about 30 foot tall. And the trunk on it's about the size of my thigh. And I got big old man thighs, not bird legs, right? I got, you know, the thighs you expect to see a guy that's had kids and grandkids have, right? It's a big tree. And so it's just something to know if you want to try to work with that. I'll save my comments on vanilla for a little bit later. If you would allow me to do that when I take someone else's suggestion and bring it to you. Next, though, I have someone who told me they're Scott, hybrid willow trees for ruminant fodder as well as shade and privacy. This is something, especially people who have at least a few acres. Or even like, you know, a half acre to an acre and you've got a perimeter you can do this on and you do rabbits. But anybody that's doing like sheep, goats, any other ruminants, rabbits, really the willow, the poplar, and the white mulberry are all things that you should be looking at. So Scott's going to be doing willow. Well, this fits out really great because it turns out Nick Ferguson is starting to do his plant sale for this year right now. In fact, there's a post on my blog about some of the things that are available there, including hybrid willow cuttings. Now, he doesn't have the cuttings available right now if you are only buying the cuttings. He's got the packages of multi-fodder trees available, but he also he was doing some work. That's why he was at my house to kind of rectify this the cuttings as well. These are incredibly easy to work with, these cuttings. You basically stick them in the ground, and as long as they get enough moisture and then they're in the right kind of place, they grow. And you know, you're a year into it and you have a tree from a stick. And so it's definitely worth learning how to propagate these and including them in the work that you're doing, especially if you are doing, again, any sort of livestock that would eat this stuff. Because it is so much less expensive than buying in hay. And it tends that most people doing this have fairly decent pasture to work with, or they're working on improving it at least. But the funny thing is that pasture and fodder tree systems complement each other really well, because when one lags in production, that tends to be the time the other one is really ramping out production. That levels things off and it frees you from the feed store. So definitely consider taking a look at that. Next up, Brenda said that she's thinking about growing tobacco, but she says she's going to be growing tobacco, hemp, and medicinal herbs of all kinds. And she has Tennessee-grown seeds on her website at beesherbshop.com. I'll make sure that I add that available as well to the notes today, because I think I missed that one. But I added a link to Victory Seeds, who is an MSB sponsor as well, because they actually have a huge array of different tobacco types. Virginia Gold, Wild Sacred, Connecticut Broadleaf, to name a few. Golden Burley, TN90 Burley, Cuban Creole, American 572, Black Sea, and a bunch more. There's a ton of different tobaccos, some that are more of an ornamental tobacco than a smoking tobacco, and some that are very much smoking tobacco. As you can see, I mean, they just have a ton of them. They even have these large packages that contain many varieties, depending on what you're looking for. They have a premier tobacco variety that I think has all of them, or almost all of them, that they sell in one package, which is pretty cool. This is what John said about tobacco, though. Tobacco makes a great ornamental just to leave the flower spike on it. It goes by Nicotina in the flower circles. Virginia Burley is my favorite for a 6 foot tall statement or background flower that the hummingbirds love. Aztec or rabbit is maybe 8 inches tall. So there's a lot of varieties. So you have plants that are only 8 inches tall up to 6 feet. They produce tons of seeds that are shiny. Start them soon so they get big enough to transplant. So it sounds like this is something that you're going to have like a window of growth issue in some climates with. You need there. It's a fairly long duration crop. So just know that if you're going to try tobacco, the time to do it is now. Next up, I'm not going to bring these up individually. There's just too many varieties here. There's three different varieties of just beans. But Matt is going to be buying all three of these beans, and I do have links to them in the notes for if you want them. All of them from Baker Creek. They are Black Turtle, Hidatsa Indian Red, and Hutterite Soup beans. But these are all dry beans, and he specifically is looking to grow beans that can be stored as dried beans for food and also for seed for replanting. That's something that there's probably a lot of folks that, you know, could benefit from adding this to what you're growing. The one thing about beans that's really cool is they are a fit-in crop is what I call them. And what I mean by that is if you have a fence line and you have a whole bunch of roses or some shit on there, you can really easily add some trellising on your fence, go in between all your bushes, and pop in something like Scarlet Runner beans. And they'll grow up your fence, they'll cover your fence, they'll make your fence last longer by protecting it from the sun. They'll grow amazing beans in these gorgeous red flowers that hummingbirds and bees and other insects love. And they'll produce these really broad, flat pod that you can eat like a green bean. But if you let them fully grow, they make a really big, gorgeous-looking kind of mottled-colored black, brown, and other color bean that is a great soup bean, dry bean, etc. I am not a big bean eater, but this is the Survival Podcast, and beans are a reliable form of protein we can grow from plants on our property. So for a lot of you guys, that's something you might want to really look at is just ask yourself this question. How much dry bean could you produce? Not doing anything more than you're already doing except just finding places to tuck them in. Again, along fence lines. You can certainly grow, let's say, one. If you have tomatoes you're staking, you can always grow like one pole bean with that tomato. Plant it right next to it. Let a little bit of that co-root mingling go on. It might help a little bit with the nitrogen. I think it's a little overblown. Tends that legumes give most of their nitrogen to the soil when they die and they still have nodules, and those nodules are released. They're not really looking to share it. But there is a definite benefit to companion planting and intertwined roots, and you already have a support there. So just one bean next to every tomato plant. If you have, you know, vegetables or ornamentals growing around trees or any sort of trellis, you can always pop some beans in all along a fence line. Any place that you can swirl them in, especially a pole variety. And most of the good dry beans are, not all, but most are good dry bean are also a pole bean. And that gives you that vertical space element. So it's definitely worth considering. Next is Okinawan sweet potatoes. And I always mess this one up because I grow a sweet potato that I always refer to as Okinawan. And what I grow is actually called Murasaki, but it's marketed as a Okinawan variety, or they call it Okinawan purple skin, or something like that. And she's growing the actual Okinawan sweet potato. I'm going to bring up a picture of her here in just a moment. Here we go. With one of them. And you can see this thing is huge. She's growing them in feed troughs because that's what she has available to grow right now. And she's going to go to bigger feed troughs this year to try to grow more of these and more really giant sweet potatoes. Now, this is what this potato actually looks like right here. And I said, this is the real Okinawan sweet potato. They are a light skin on the outside and a purple flesh with a little bit of a lighter colored, like whitish veining in the flesh. These are supposed to be fantastic. I have to tell you, I've never had one. So I don't, you know, all I know is their reputation. And I have no reason to doubt that they're fantastic. They certainly get really, really big. When I say Okinawan sweet potatoes, and I need to stop saying that, I need to call them Murasaki, which is the name they were actually given. Now, I also want to tell you, though, why I call them that, or why that confusion happens. And it's because the people that developed this sweet potato wanted it to sell. And Murasaki is an Okinawan word. I don't remember what it means. It probably means purple or something like that. But they made it sound Asian so it would be cooler. But I don't remember which college it was, but this was actually developed in a United States college's agricultural program. And even though it's not what she was talking about, I want to remind you guys about these. I grow these every year. These are the best sweet potatoes I have ever grown. From a standpoint of how they taste, I can bake one of these and eat it with nothing on it. No butter, no oil, no nothing. I'm not going to say I do that a lot. I'm saying I can. They almost taste like they have a small amount of butter on them before you even put butter on them. They also make, this is a guilty pleasure, yes, it's carbs, one of the best twice fried French fry I have ever had in my life. This pepper, if you bake it or put it in a stew and slow cook it in a stew till it's soft, it gets very sweet. A different sweet, but very sweet. I would say more like the sweetness of a parsnip than a sweet potato in a stew or a soup. If you dry bake it or fry it, the sweetness actually mitigates the other direction, sort of like if you make a plantain, if you're familiar with, you know, plantains. If you cook a plantain where it's kind of sticky and what have you, it's sweet. It gets really, really sweet. And it's the same family as a banana. But if you fry them till they're crispy, they taste more like a potato than a banana. It's kind of like that. And the twice fried, so you cut them into steak fries, fry them until they're cooked to where you could eat them, drain them and let them completely cool down to room temperature and fry them a second time. They get this incredible outer coating. And the middle is like a pillow. And by the way, the leaves are edible. They're a good green for you to eat. And my ducks eat the crap out of these things. And once they're established, they're almost impossible to kill. In fact, you have to make them suffer a little bit at the end of the season. I'll hold back watering. Most of the time, this is true with sweet potatoes in general. I'll hold back watering a little bit at the end of the season because that's what makes them uber productive. They want to have a little bit of stress. That sends the message, hey guys, you need to put energy into reproduction because a sweet potato reproduces. They can make an actual seed, by the way, but mostly they reproduce by setting tubers, and then those tubers have vines that have tubers that have vines that have tubers. They clone themselves. So check this out. And art by Lee Murphy says that Lady Murasaki is a famous historic person in Japan. Okay. So that makes sense. So again, what I said is true. They just ripped them off. And Second Life Farm says it was developed by LSU, I think. I think you're right. I wanted to say that, but I wasn't sure. And I didn't want to say it because I wasn't sure. But now that you're saying it, and that's what I'm thinking, I'm going to go there. I'm pretty sure it's the same program that the Nutty Groundnut came out of, because they're the ones that developed those Nutty Groundnuts. And LSU's done some pretty cool stuff. They've also developed the LSU Purple Fig, So LSU purple, I guess you can understand maybe why that's the case there. But definitely, again, worth checking out. Cotton, I don't think I have any links for you. Let me check here. I do. I have a link to Southern Exposure Seeds. I'm going to say something about Southern Exposure right now, and it's going to sound very negative. And it's only because I believe that I should disclose any information I have to you. I'm going to tell you that I only feel this way about live plants from them, specifically live plants that they're not growing themselves. And it's exactly tied into our last discussion. Last year, I ordered sweet potato slips from like four or five varieties of sweet potato from them. Stuff I had never grown before. Couldn't get the potatoes locally, what have you. They all came in like absolute dog shit. They were dead when they got here. There wasn't a leaf on the stem when they got here. I even did try throw them in water, see what happens. No. They looked like somebody put them in a dehydrator for a day before they sent them to me. That's how bad they were. They were extremely late getting here. They were 6 weeks after they were supposed to be here. I don't know if they were in the mail for 6 weeks. That would explain things. When I emailed them, they blamed the producer. So obviously they have a third party growing them for them. They did eventually refund my money after a few threats. They never took responsibility. It was more like, I'm sorry, this happened to you. Not, I'm sorry, we did this to you. No ownership. Complete deferral. So why am I featuring them here? Because I've also ordered seeds from them. And I've never had a problem ordering seeds from them. And they always ship fast and always got what I asked for. And there's certain things that they seem to do better than others. And there's certain things that you really can't get anywhere else, especially a lot of things when you start looking for it. Oh, there's a place and it's in the UK. Oh, there's a place and it's Australia, but they have them. And so that's why they also have a hell of a selection of cotton varieties. So that's why I made them the link for today. There's a lot more types of cotton, I think, than people realize. I don't know that I would ever grow cotton other than anything other than maybe a curiosity. But it's certainly something you can look at growing. And there are some varieties actually that are actually quite ornamental if they are grown in the right place and in the right way. There's none on the Southern Exposure Seed Exchange, but I've seen some. I think Baker Creek is where I saw like this pink. It's kind of cool, right? So that's anyway what Jessica is growing. Walking onions and Good King Henry are both being grown by someone called Lance. So let's talk about these walking onions. And again, I want you to understand that I am not pushing anybody when I give you these links today. I am just giving you an example of the plant. So if you're interested in it and you go to the notes and you click that link and you go there, you know exactly what we're talking about, because common names can be confusing. And Latin names are things that nobody can write down driving a car listening to a podcast, right? But I try to give you information like I just did. Like Southern Exposure Seed Company, I would totally buy seeds from them. I would not buy plants from them ever again. Just the way it is. And I'll also say people like Baker Creek can be a little pricey versus the quantity, but they have things nobody else does, and it's always perfect. Like, you always get what you ordered, and if they mess something up, they fix it, right? Then I'll tell you places, I don't know. Never ordered from them, so I don't know. But the next one is Walking Onion. Again, this is from Lance, and this is I really should reach out to these people. I'm just not sure they could handle what could happen, because I've seen them sold out before, but I'm probably going to order from these guys. They are EgyptianWalkingOnion.com, and they have several different varieties of Egyptian walking onions. And if you've never seen these, they grow a small onion, but what happens is they get a top set. And a top set, I was looking to see if there's anywhere here they actually show one. They do not. Oh, there it is right there. Cluster of top sets. So if you've ever grown garlic and let it gone to seed, then you probably know what I'm talking about. It'll form what looks almost like a little flower on the top, but then there's little bulbs in there. And those are like little garlics, and you can actually let them get to a certain size and then pull them out and plant them, and they'll grow another plant. These Egyptian walking onions do the same thing, but the top gets so heavy that it literally, if you think about an onion stalk is not that robust, and it's not like a garlic where it's like this little cluster. It's a pretty good sized cluster of these onion bulbs. And so eventually that stalk falls over. Those bulblets make contact with the ground, they root and grow a new plant. So we can do this intentionally with certain plants. It's called layering. So cane fruits are great for this. You take a new growth this year, green stem of a raspberry, for instance, and you bend it over and you bury the end and it'll root. And once it roots, you can then cut it off and you have a new plant. The leaves are just upside down, and then it will start to produce from that crown and make a new plant, right? So you can do this intentionally with layering. This plant is basically using nature's layering. It drops, and then that roots, and it's getting support from the mother plant until it gets roots established, and then it grows again, and it does it again and again and again and again. I have never grown these. I have meant to grow these for a long time. I probably should add this to my, yes, I'm going to grow them this year thing. I know Nicole grows these and loves them. But again, they're called Egyptian walking onions. And that came in from, let me see again. Why am I not finding this? Lance. Lance is the one that said that. Lance is also going to grow a plant that I wanted to make sure I told you guys about today. This is I think this is a very much underrated plant in the gardening world today. It's called Good King Henry. Good King Henry. And Good King Henry is a Chenopodium species. And the Chenopodium species is the goosefoot family. And it's generally things that are spinach-like, and that is the case with Good King Henry. But Good King Henry, it has a leaf form factor that is very similar to, like, what's the water plant I'm thinking of? Like taro or arrowhead. It's got an arrowhead-looking leaf to it, except it is not a water plant, though it does like moister soils. It also has a pretty cool little seed head that gets on it, that if you cut it at the right time, is somewhere between like an asparagus and a broccoli and a broccolini. But it's a perennial, which means once you establish it in most climates, you have it forever. And so that is one of the best perennial vegetables with multiple uses of stalk, leaf, and seed head that we have. Now, most of the production you're going to get from it, as with most Chenopodiums, are going to be early in the season. So it's an early season producer, but it survives and will come back year after year for you. So if you're looking for things like that, if you want more perennial production in your life, and let's be, you know, who among us doesn't want more perennial production in your life? Maybe take a look at these. Next up today is Roy. He said, my new thing this year was actually last year for me. I started a golden seal patch as well as valerian, also triple crown blackberry. Okay. The triple crown blackberry is an amazing plant. It's an absolute fantastic plant. It is a high yielding primacane blackberry. So primacane means it produces on the second year cane only. But it is also thornless. So there are what are called floricane. I'm sorry, primacane. Yeah, I've got it backwards. Primacanes will produce on the cane the first year. I'm sorry. Oh, try to fight that. The first year and the second year. And so they're a double yield plant. Floricane, which is what most are, is only going to produce on the second year cane. And so you prune off your two-year-old canes every year at the end when they're going to die anyway, and then the new growth fruits the next season, and new growth comes the next season as well, become the next crop. So it's not one of your ever-bearing blackberries, as some people call them. But since it's thornless, and it produces huge berries. It is a fantastic crop for the home grower. Really is, and it's super easy to propagate too, even though technically it is a patented variety. I don't think anybody's going to know if you happen to make more. It's the thing about blackberry is you can't even stop blackberries from making more blackberries. They're gonna self-layer and they're gonna spread and clump all by themselves. You can just kind of control the direction that happens. So just a few plants in the right soil, if you have good blackberry climate and growing conditions, you're going to have blackberries until you don't know what to do with them after a few years. So it's definitely worth checking out. Roy also, like you said, he's been doing a lot with what he calls forest farming. So he's been improving and adding to a lot of things that people, if he's from West Virginia, things that people wild forage already, but a lot of wild foragers, what they're actually doing is they're actually encouraging the growth on their own property up to the point of doing things like harvesting a bunch of leeks or golden seal root or whatever from other land they have access to, and then planting patches of it on their own land. And the valerian is a great medicinal with some real cash value to it. So I have links to that as well. Next up, I have this from Nicole. Not that Nicole, though. This is not Nicole Awesome Sauce. This is a different Nicole. I love Baker Creek. This year, I want to grow snap peas and purple teepee beans. I thought that was a typo. That's exactly what they're called. I got links to all this stuff. I'm also starting a flower garden for my farm stand. Today, I'm going to winter sow seeds with my children. We'll be sowing kale, spinach, lettuce, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, beets, carrots, and some herbs like chives, thyme, oregano, lavender, parsley, cilantro, and chamomile. Also some flowers like echinacea, poppies, calendula, villas, pansies, and yarrow, bachelor button, and sweet alyssum. I think I'll winter sow every month until the beginning of April this year. Best time of the year is right around the corner, Nicole. Winter sowing is something we all need to play a little bit more with, including sometimes with things that we would think, hey, I have to start that inside, like peppers and tomatoes, especially in our southern climates. I would say anywhere like southern Virginia, southern West Virginia, south, there's a lot of climates in there that have plenty of time to grow a plant from seed to production, even all outdoors. And usually when we get a volunteer, it outproduces the little plant that we started in February and we loved on and we blessed it and we held our tongue a certain way when we added the nutrient, and then this tomato falls and hits the ground and outproduces everything. So we can encourage that type of thing as well with winter sowing, which is exactly what it sounds like, distributing seed in winter and letting the seed decide when it wants to grow. Your germination rates will never be what they will be, you know, proper timed. Because some of the seed will get blown away, some of it will get washed away, some of it will get eaten, some of it will sprout when it shouldn't and get killed. But the ones that adapt end up being land race material. Land race is where we keep producing the same thing on the same block of land for multiple years, and we end up with something very specifically adapted, beyond regional adaptation. Basically, your property adapted, and that's about as good as it gets. Good stuff there from Nicole. Colleen is going to be growing apples that she's growing from seed that she got from New Zealand. I'd like to know more about that, but that was all the information I got. Yvette is going to be growing luffa. They have a long growing season, so we'll be starting them soon. There's a lot of things that people further north in the country think they can't grow. And it is a duration window, and you want to have some buffer on your duration. If it says it needs 90 days to produce and you have 96, you really need to move back, because not only do you need production, but, like, let's be honest, the first thing a plant produces usually is not a large amount. Like, it'll make one or two and then more and what have you, right? Now, luffa, I don't think you're gonna have much trouble with this at all, but if you're far enough north, definitely start these now. Luffa is just a gourd. So if you can grow birdhouse gourds or any type of gourd, you can probably grow luffa fairly well. But if you're anywhere, I'd say north of Oklahoma or even northern Oklahoma, yeah, these should probably be starting seeds very soon. I'm going to save a tip for starting gourd seeds for a later plant that is actually a gourd, even though most people would never call it a gourd. And a lot of gourds share this germination problem. And I'm going to tell you how to take your germination from like 40% to like 100%. And it's super stupid simple to do. Then Trevor said he's going to be growing Japanese black Trafili tomato, chufa, and something called Bambara beans. The Japanese tomato, I was like really wondering, like, what is that? What is that? Is it like black? Like, it's actually not really black. It is more of one of these like multicolor, like green with some purplish black and some really deep reds in it. And I'm going to bring it up on the screen for you here in just a second to take a look at. It's a really cool looking tomato. It really is. I think when I read this one and looked this one up in the description, I would have grown this year. I've already got all my tomato seeds either saved from last year or ordered for this year and the plan done already. And I don't grow that many tomato plants. I grow on the order of about 8 to 10 tomato plants a year. So I don't have room for this one this year, but it looks really, really cool. The other plant that she said she was going to grow is something called Bambara beans. This was a new one to me. Bambara beans are actually I guess they're a legume, but they grow in the ground like peanuts do in a way. And I'm trying to find, I have a Plants for the Future database link for you to learn more about them, but I've got a source of seed too. Let me get this up and I'll show you what they look like. They indeed look like a bean. They're also referred to as a groundnut, but they are not the groundnut that we think of, Apis americana, that I've talked to you guys a lot about in the future. They look like kind of a little brown bean. They're very high in protein. I do not know, you know, are they I know nothing about them. This one place I found seed for them is sold out. But I've also found that you can buy them, like on Amazon, by the pound to eat. They're a commercial crop. I see no reason why you wouldn't be able to get those to germinate. However, I could be wrong, but they seem very inexpensive that way. So what I would do is give them an overnight soak and then plant them in a warm, moist soil, something with like a heat pad and a humidity dome to give yourself the best chance of getting them to sprout. Another thing you can do with things like this when you're trying to see if you can get them to sprout is the paper towel trick. Take a wet, damp paper towel, fold a few layers of it, put them on it and fold that in half, put that in a zip top bag, seal it and set it somewhere warm. The top of a cable TV box is fantastic for this because it's also where you're going to see it and won't forget that you've done it. Check it every day. And if you see little rootlets start, then get them in the ground. So I have no experience with this other than to tell you, I looked it up and it looks pretty freaking cool. I can't tell though, like, this looks like it, like this used to be grown as a commercial crop. I did a little bit of research and it looks to me like maybe the reason it's not one anymore is processing may be a pain in the ass. Because first of all, it's a tuber. That means you got to pull it out of the ground like a peanut, right? And you got to clean it off and get it off the roots. But it also comes in a hole like peanuts do. And that, I don't know what the hulling process is like for them. But it's, you know, something you can take a look at and see if maybe it's something you want to give a try to. Very, very interesting looking thing. Again, very high in protein and just something new and unique. I also saw something I'm going to do some more research on over the weekend. I saw it over the weekend and I'm going to do some more research on it. And it's growing peanuts, and apparently it's becoming a thing in a lot of like third world countries and what have you, because they have such a need for protein that people are growing peanuts in things like tires, using nothing but organic waste, kind of compost in place, plant peanut seeds and keep, you know, add another tire and add more compost and then add another and do that and getting really great yields. In some cases, it's reported up to 10 kilograms of peanuts per tire tower. That's almost 20 pounds, right? or a little over 20 pounds, actually, I think. That's a lot of protein for people that, you know, is animal protein superior to vegetable protein? Yes. You'll never get an argument from me the other direction. Yes. But what you don't have, you don't have. And the ability to produce that is certainly worth looking into, too. Second Light Farm says, my chickens love everything, but one of the things that is easiest to grow, just plant it and forget about it, is squash and pumpkin. My chickens go apeshit for it. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know what else loves to carve a hole in a pumpkin or a squash? And it really eats only the seeds then? Friggin' squirrels, man. Gray squirrels love to get the seeds out of those, just so you know. I did have a question on hunting squirrels come in after our little cooking bit on squirrels with Ken last week, so maybe we'll talk about that in a variety show soon. I'm going to do a whole show just on it. I think I did one in the past. Also, this person is going to be growing chufa. Chufa is another tuber that grows in the ground. It grows under a clump of grass that looks sort of like mondo grass, if you know what that is. It doesn't look exactly like it, but it's similar. I've grown that. They actually make a drink out of it, and I can't think of what it's called now. It's known as tiger almond as well. It's fine for what it is. I found it to be too much of a pain in the ass to be worth harvesting. Most of the people I know that grow it for turkeys or pigs who will dig it up and eat it and self-process it. Or what they'll do a lot. I've had a couple people tell me that have hogs or turkeys that maybe they won't do it right away, but you pull a few out in front of them and they come over and check it out. And once they know what it is, they'll take it from there and uproot it and eat it themselves. Also very high in protein as well for a vegetable source. Russ is going to be growing Mennonite sorghum. Mennonite sorghum is a dual-purpose sorghum. So most sorghums have been bred across time, whether they're heirloom or a hybrid variety, to be geared toward grain production or syrup production. Almost all of them will do both to a degree. But as you know, we've talked about this with egg chickens versus meat chickens. Something that's dual purpose generally doesn't excel at either one. Yeah. I'm not going to say Mennonite excels at either one. But it's as good at both purposes as some purpose grown ones are. So, I mean, something like white African giant sorghum is a huge, super tall grain sorghum. It is going to produce way more grain than Mennonite. It just per acre, it is, okay? But it's a piss poor syrup sorghum. Mennonite has a good squeeze syrup potential and a great grain production as well. So I'm not going to bring up a screenshot of it. It looks like grass with seed heads on the top of it because that's what sorghum is. But I actually did a show. If you go to the website and you put sorghum in the search box, even though I don't grow a lot of high carbohydrate stuff, I understand that other people do, and there's a place for it, any purpose for it. I did a whole show on sorghum is probably the best homegrown grain that most home growers can grow for a variety of reasons. Dustin said he's going to be growing. It sounds like he's looking to grow smaller things, cute little smaller things. He's going to be growing orange hat tomato, which is a small compact bush tomato. It's a tomato actually that a lot of people that do aquaponics grow because it is a determinate tomato, so it doesn't just keep going and it stays relatively small, though it's not that productive. I will just let you know that. Then Tom Thumb garden peas, that's another small kind of dwarf pea variety. I've grown those. They're really good. They actually have a fantastic function. And that is that you can interplant those peas and they stay compact and they're productive for their size, okay? But when you plant early and you're first setting out your plants, you can interplant them and they'll give you a quick, fast production. You can pick those peas. As soon as the hot weather comes, they're going to get slayed, and then your long season plants take over the space. So it's kind of like a freebie, especially – once you've grown it a couple seasons and you're producing your own seed, it's kind of like just an extra free thing. That's something you can get out of. It's not what it was grown for. It was designed to be a container P. But I'm telling you, that is a great application of it. He's also going to be growing something called Orchard Baby Sweet Corn. And I've never grown that, but you know what? I think I do have that one and I can pull it up for you. It's just basically a small corn. Tom Thumb Garden Trumbuscino Orchard Baby Sweet Corn right here. Share this tab instead. So let me get that up for you guys that are on the video. All right. And I'll kind of scroll through it while I talk about, you know, what the application is. This basically, it's a shorter stalked corn, so it's more compact. Its stalks are going to stand 3 to 5 feet tall, 2 ears per cob. But it's a short season corn. And I'll tell you what that may be ideal for. There are a lot of places where it is difficult to grow homegrown corn because you have a lot of cornworm activity. And the cornworm activity from the GMO production is actually worse than it ever was. And the damn things are harder to kill than they ever were. But they tend not to be very active really super early in the season. This stuff produces so quickly from a seasonal standpoint that it is going to be done before your corn earworms are really out in force. So you're kind of beating them on timing is a way to look at it. And again, it's, since it's a smaller compact corn stalk, it's something you can interplant, grow it up, take your harvest off it, let the freaking little stalks stand. They're not going to take up that much space. Let them dry out. Let them rot their roots in the ground. Plant some beans around them and make it a sort of, what do you call it, Three Sisters garden. You could kind of play with that as you will. Safe, that's his name, Safe, said that he is going to be trying to grow garlic. It's going to be his second time trying. He's going to be trying early Italian and a variety called Texas Rose. Second time, that tends to tell me I did this before and it didn't work. And I'm going to tell you that it might not work this year either. And I think the reason you're going to understand is your plant timing. When you're setting out garlic, the garlic that you would be growing this year should have been put out around September last year, September, October. When I was a kid, I talked about the bulblets on the garlic. My grandfather used to grow elephant garlic, and I used to pull it every year, and we'd leave a few to produce bulblets for next year. And then we would take those bulblets, and I would put it all on this great big grate. We'd set it up on a couple tires to dry out and cut the tops off it, dry them out, and sack it all into garlic sacks. But the ones that produced bulblets for the next year's seed, that went in the ground, I mean, right about the end of dove season, so the end of September before it got really cold. I would go back and plug them all in the ground, and they would stay in there through the winter, and then they would come up and start growing earnestly in the spring. In my experience, now maybe I'm wrong, maybe somebody's cracked the code, maybe there's different varieties. In my experience, that's pretty much how things go when it comes to garlic. You want to be planting them the year in advance. He also said he is growing Trumbuscino because, well, some dumb redneck duck farmer told him to do that a few years ago, and now he can't stop growing it. Trumbuscino is my favorite squash to grow. It is a squash that is both a summer and winter squash at the same time. It grows really huge. It grows a really long kind of handle and a big bulb at the end. And the beauty of the big bulb at the end is all the seeds are in that bulb, meaning that entire stalk, handle, call it whatever you want to, is pure squash. So it's great for making zoodles, and you can pick it when it's green and it's a summer squash, and you can pick it after it turns orange and it's closer to like a butternut, and it will store very long term once it turns. That is one of those squashes, though. Squirrels really like it. When I leave them on to fully ripen and turn into a winter squash, I have to keep an eye on them, and I'll eventually see one of them with bite holes and having the seeds taken, and at that point, I got to take them all. Like my first squirrel hits the first one. If I don't take them then, they're gonna clean me out at the end of the year. This is also the squash that looks at squash vine borers and goes, I see what you're doing. I understand your place in the ecosystem. Go for it. I'm not saying it doesn't get vine borers. I'm saying it usually survives and it doesn't feed them well. The vine borer is a moth and it lays what looks like a maggot. And it lays an egg that hatches into this maggot thing. And that maggot thing bores into the stalk of your squash. And when you go out and you see your squash, you know, in early summer when it starts to get hot and like the leaves just look like it hasn't been watered in a week. And you water it, it still stays that way. But as soon as the sun goes down, the leaves come back, but it's not happy. And eventually it dies. And then it's like just the core of it looks like it's rotted out. That's squash vine borer damage. They are the menace of society. And they hit like zucchini and a lot of others. I think it's Cuberta moschetta is there's four squash families, and the moschetta, I think, is the one that the trombuscino's in. The long neck and butternuts all tend to be in this category where instead of this great big giant thick vine, you get a much thinner, more gourd-like vine that's very dense, and so there's just not a lot to feed on in there. So it tends to be something they don't like very much, and I have gotten excellent production out of trombuscino every year that I've grown it. Next up is this tomato called the Everglades tomato. And this is also being grown by Safe. This is a cool little tomato. It is designed to be a tomato that can handle heat and humidity, where most tomatoes stop producing when that heat comes. And when they get too humid, they get blight and other problems. So tomato is actually a difficult crop in many ways to grow in Florida. These are also known as wild Florida Everglades tomatoes. That's a small current size tomato. So they're a little tomato. I did grow these one year because we have heat, if not humidity here, and they did fairly well for me. I think they're probably more adapted to a more humid climate than what I have. So you can, you know, take my advice with a grain of salt there. But the Everglades tomato might be worth taking a look at. I also have Tracy here, and I do have a link to this, but I'm not going to pull it up just for brevity's sake, but these are called baby bear pumpkins. She says they're supposed to be small, around 2 pounds when mature, a sweet pumpkin. She got her seeds from a company called Roar's Seeds in eastern PA, close to where she lives. Also thinking of experimenting with an asparagus bed this year, Tracy. Asparagus is something we probably all should grow. And I learned something about asparagus over the years, and that is if you stay on it, you can get a lot of production out of asparagus well into the year when people think it's done for the year. If you keep some of it pruned back and you don't take everything, it will continue to send up new fern shoots, because that's what asparagus is. It's a shoot that eventually turns into a great big, beautiful fern. So that's cool. Ralph said, and then the baby bear pumpkins, I've never grown these. I've never heard of them before, but they look like a great choice for someone that wants to do pumpkins, but don't want the big, huge, giant pumpkins and the big, huge plants. Ralph says he's going to be growing Jerusalem artichoke. If you've never eaten Jerusalem artichoke, I recommend that you go to some place like a Central Market, a Whole Foods or something like that, where they sell them, get them and try them one or two or three different ways and decide, is this something you're going to eat? Now, if you want to grow it just to grow it, it's your land. Do whatever you want. They're not something everybody's going to like. And they also have a nickname, fartichokes. And you ain't kidding. Now, the one thing I'll say for the fartichoke, it's all gas, no blast. All right. Like, it is not a stinky. I don't understand, but it's not a stinky fart. It's a pure air, warm and dry, or cool and dry fart, right? The warmer and the moister a fart, the nastier it is and the quieter it is. These are loud, cool, dry, annoyance farts is the only way I can describe it. And it actually is kind of digestive stress for some people as well. Other people, it's just an annoyance, right? But I know two ways to prepare them where they're not fartichokes anymore. One is a very long and slow cooking process that makes a gruel, in my opinion, almost like a when somebody tries to make mashed potatoes out of cauliflower and they go too far with it, because I don't think it's good anyway. But like, I do not like mashed cauliflower. But the only way I like cauliflower is riced, and you cook all of the cauliflower stink out of it and put other things with it to absorb flavor, and it's pretty good. Otherwise, I don't do cauliflower at all. The cauliflower mash, not good. It tastes like a sweet cauliflower mash. It's like a cauliflower mash meets cream of wheat with sugar, in my opinion. But when you do that, you break down the carbohydrates, and I can't remember what they're called. Inulin is the form that they are, which is a very complex form, which only can be digested in your lower stomach. And when you do that, that's where all that cool, dry fart comes from, okay? From that breakdown in your lower stomach. The converse with that, though, is if you're trying to keep your blood sugar down, when you break all that inulin down into actual sugars, now you're back to having a blood spike. So I don't like the taste, the flavor, the texture, or the biological impact that way, so I don't eat them that way. There's one other way, and I think they're fantastic this way. Lactofermentation. So you slice them up, you peel them, slice them up, put them in a jar with a salt brine like you would any fermented vegetable, and give them about 7 days. That lactofermentation breaks down that inulin in a different way. They become tart, a little bit sour like you would expect, like a sauerkraut sour, and they stay crisp, and they don't get sweet. And what that would tell me is that it's doing a different process on that inulin. It's not going to a pure sugar. And so you're going to have that same mitigation to your blood sugar. Groundnut, Apis americana groundnut, and Jerusalem artichoke both have a muting effect on blood sugar. They actually not only don't produce a spike, when consumed with other carbohydrates, they reduce the spike. They flatten the curve, right? So that's just a good thing to know. So those fermented, they're fantastic. However, why am I saying go buy them before you grow them? First year I ever grew them, somebody from your audience, this audience here, said, hey, Jack, I heard you want to try them. I'll send you some. Okay, great. Send them to me. So this is in the spring, and I had just started to put some beds in. I had a single 10-foot long, 3-foot wide, mounded raised bed. This guy sends me, he says, cut them up into pieces and plant them, and you'll have more than you know what to do with. I figured he's going to send me, like, you know, a pretty good amount of them. He sends me, like, 3 of them. And they're not that big. They're smaller than your, like, they're half the size of my fist, maybe. So I cut these 3 or 4 of them up into about 12 pieces. And I put them all in this, spread them out and put them in this bed. In a couple of months, the bed, it looks like a giant woolly worm of, you know, these 2-foot high plants growing. And they end up growing about 10 foot tall. I'm like, well, I wonder how productive they are. I got 4.5, almost 5, 5-gallon buckets, and I wasn't miserly pulling them out of the thing. So all I'm saying is if you grow a few of these, the yield in a good fertile system is going to be huge. And if you don't eat them or have something to feed them to, you've done all that for nothing. So give them a try first. Pigs apparently love these things too. Another way that people eat them, and I have found that this does not cause the farting reaction, is raw, especially with like a, what do you call it? I want to say guillotine, but that's not the right word. The thing that you, won't come to me now, that you slice things really, a mandolin, right? You take them on a mandolin, use the little attachment so you don't skin your hands, and do super thin slices of them like on a salad raw. I think probably the reason you don't get the fart response out of that is you just don't eat that many that way. They are delicious fried like potatoes, but then you get the fart artichoke effect. So probably more than you needed to know about Jerusalem artichokes. Then here's a new one that I just found out about. I have never heard of this before. This is a squash, and it is called Winter Candy Roaster North Georgia. And I'm wondering if the North Georgia thing here is like Georgia in the United States or like Georgia in Russia or something like that. Because every place that I found selling seeds for this plant other than Baker Creek was like a UK or an Aussie site. So I'm just that just makes me wonder if that's the case. Anyway, let me get this one up for you guys here. This is a very interesting squash. For those that are on audio only, I'll try to describe it. It's a large cylindrical squash, kind of forms almost like a crescent, and it has it tapers to a point on both ends. It's kind of a green-gray stripe and like a pink-orange mix. When you cut it open, it looks a lot like a sweet potato color, orange sweet potato color inside big rings. And it looks really, really interesting. Well, it turns out that there's a lot of people growing this squash for their livestock, not for themselves. And so let me see if I can, again, on my notes here, find this. This was from Rob. Rob said, let me make sure I'm showing you the right stuff. I am. Winter candy roaster squash, North Georgia. I filled the bucket of my tractor. The bucket of his tractor, three times off four seeds that he planted. So he planted four seeds. You're talking a front end loader. So probably like the little Kubotas and shit are like a third yard bucket. I think the smallest front end loader bucket I've ever seen is like a quarter yard, right? So maybe a quarter yard bucket would be about as small as you would go there. He filled it three times. It's freaking three quarters of a yard at a minimum off four seeds. But this is what I thought was interesting. We haven't eaten any ourselves, but the animals go crazy over them. And if I remember right, later in the discussion, he said hogs in particular and cattle love the shit out of these things. So with that kind of production, even if you don't grow it for yourself, I may order some of this too today, just for the hell of it. And one thing I didn't find out, and I probably should, is what is this? Oh, it's a Maxima. So it's a Cuberta Maxima. So that is going to be subject to the terror of the squash vine borer. I'll just say that if you live in a place where that is your nemesis, you're going to have to deal with it however you normally deal with it. It's not a machete, unfortunately. And the sweeter winter squashes tend not to be the machete, or it's mixed. I don't remember which one. I think there's four of them. And the ones that are the most resilient tend to be not quite as sweet as the ones that are less resistant to the stupid freaking flies, the squash vine borers. Thad, you know there's a couple things I'm congratulating you on right now, and good for you. But Thad is the only thing he said he's going to grow this year he's never grown for is ground cherry. He's going to be getting those from Baker Creek. Ground cherry is an underrated thing. Those of you who want something, a sweet fruit type thing, but you don't want to wait a year or two or three till you get real production. This is an annual plant. It looks like a tomatillo. It is super sweet. It is like similar to gooseberry with none of the tartness, all the sweetness. And has a little husk that has to be peeled off. They're incredibly productive. They start producing in warmer climates about 60 days from seed. They don't get very big as a plant. They keep growing like an indeterminate tomato, but they don't need to be very big before they produce their first fruits. And so if you're looking for something you can grow in the vegetable garden as an annual, but use like a fruit, ground cherry is a great way to go, hence the name ground cherry. John says he's going to be growing python snake beans. This is something I've grown a lot, and I love them, and I said I would save a hack for getting the seeds to start here. The python snake bean is not a bean. It kind of looks like a melon or some kind of weird cucumber or something like that. What it actually is a gourd. And they get huge. And they're delicious even when they're big. The bigger they get, the more you need to peel them before you eat them. When they're really young, if you go ahead and pick them then and slice them up and eat them, the peel is really not very fibrous, so you can eat it peel and all. As they get bigger, I've tried it with the peel on it, and it just gets a little bit of like, kind of like celery string gets in your throat when you eat like the bigger, thicker stalks of celery raw, that thing going on. Or if you eat raw snap peas and one's a little bit too mature, it has that stringy thing going on. So I would peel them when they get bigger. They are dual purpose because when they get really big and you open them up, there is a red pulp that you'll find all the seeds in. And this red pulp tastes a lot like tomato paste, but not as it's more fruity than a tomato is. And you can use it exactly like that. So you still have the outer, the huge thing. And I've seen people cook them and make pickles out of them. And both of them seem to be really well received, but I've never done the pickling thing. The way I cook these things, again, if they're big, I peel them. If they're small, I just chop them up, slice them into kind of like the size of like you would make a green bean. Olive oil, salt, flat top griddle, saute them until they're soft. Not super soft, just like al dente soft. And I've made them at a couple of workshops. And people are always like, what did you do? What did you do there? Like, what did you put on there? Salt, olive oil, and heat. That's it. They have like a cross between like a bean and a cucumber taste. And when you cook them, they move more toward the bean side. And when you eat them raw or, as I understand it, pickled, they move more toward the cucumber side. Plus you have that pulp and the seeds. Now, here's my hack for you on the seeds of these things, which have terrible germination rate if you don't do this, like 15%. But you're going to find most of your gourds are going to have germination rates between somewhere around 15, 20% up to about 40 to 60%. And there's a reason. Gourds are from very warm climates. They need a substantial impediment to germination to cause only the perfect conditions to get them to germinate. And so any gourd, when you take seed out of it, it's going to have like this slimy coating on the seeds, kind of like a watermelon multiplied, to where if you squeeze it in between your fingers, it'll shoot out again like a watermelon seed, but with much more velocity, right? When they dry, that coating doesn't go away. It turns into like a shellac. And it takes a heroic aquatic event to get that slime off, permeate that shell, and then actually cause a sprout. And most of the ones that propagate on their own probably pass through some sort of a bird or an animal that breaks that, because that outer shell, it's really a shell with a seed inside it. And that outer shell is really, really thick and hard, and it's got that coating on it. That's true of all gourds, but especially this thing. All you do, this is all you got to do, take a piece of sandpaper and give about 3 rubs until you can actually see that you've scored into the shell, and usually you can actually see there's a little opening, and you can see the seed inside it. You don't want to go so much that you go into the seed, but just after you do it a couple times, you're like, oh, I get it. Throw it in water for a couple hours and then plant it. You'll get almost 100% germination, which takes the cost of your seeds and drops it way down, because it's fairly expensive as a seed plant, because there's not that many seeds per fruit. You'll have a huge amount of goo comes out of them, but only a few of them they need to be fully formed seeds to reproduce. And since people like to eat them younger, not that many are saved all the way into maturity to get the larger seeds. But the python snake bean is amazing. Here's a couple more things about this one. If you touch the leaves, you then touch you smell your hands and you're like, what is that smell? I know it, it's so foreign that it would be, it's such a common smell that when you realize what it is, you're like, of course it is. But you're like, what is that? I know that. It's familiar, but it doesn't make any sense. It smells like peanut butter. The leaves smell like peanut butter. The flowers are very small opening, and they are very cool looking. They look like something to be on a Star Trek episode, on some, you know, weird thing growing on actually the whole plant looks like some weird thing that would, you know, be alien species have this thing, that vegetable they eat or something, right? But the issue with that, bees can't pollinate it. It's pollinated by moths. And those moths tend to not be very active in the middle of the heat of summer. So what usually happens when I grow it here, I'll get a little bit of production early. The heat comes, I get no production. The plant does fine. And as we come into the cooler nights, because these are moths that come out at night, they're a night moth. And when those moths become active, it gets a lot more production. This year, I'm going to try again to manually pollinate. It seems very difficult. It's a very small opening to the flower, and it's not real obvious exactly how much pollen, where the pollen is, et cetera. It's not, I mean, doing it with a squash, like literally take a male flower and just touch stamen and pistil and you're gold, right? This is more complicated. I've done peppers which requires a little bit of flower surgery to do it right, because it's a perfect flower and you don't want the one you're taking pollen from is fine, but you don't want the one you're bringing it to self-pollinate. So it's a little complicated. This is way more complicated. This is way, way more complicated, but it's totally worth growing. And if you live in a little bit more northern climate, you might not get that darth in the summer like we do here. But definitely check them out. Baker Creek makes these. I have a link for you there. Crystal, who is in Minnesota or Wisconsin or Michigan, one of those places, she's going to be trying to grow the butterfly pea flower. Again, this may be some of the people having trouble with it. The northern thing may be the issue. So if nothing else, go ahead and get it started early, like right now is what I would say, the pea flower. She also said she tried to grow mouse melon but has not had success. Mouse melon, also known as Mexican sour gherkin. This is something I grow these every year. I love them. They're a fantastic little plant. I've never had trouble getting them to grow either direct seeded or started in a pot. They're a very small leaf, very tiny, thin vine. They're very easy to accidentally, like when they're first starting to grow, like run your hand across the bed, not see them and break it off right at the root, and then it's not going to grow. The other thing about them is they grow this like really tangled mass, huge mass for how small the leaves are. The seeds are tiny. And if you don't look really close, you can actually have a lot of production and never see them. They actually look like a little striped watermelon. They grow about the size of a grape. They're fantastic. They're delicious. They're like a super crunchy cucumber flavored thing with a little bit of a sour back note. They're also fantastic pickled. And because I never get that many at one time, what I do is save pickle juice from a previous pickle and just have that jar. And every time I go out there, pick a bunch of them, eat a few fresh, and throw them in the jar in the refrigerator till that jar is full. And if I get two jars a year out of it that way, I consider myself successful. What I'm saying, Crystal, is it may have grown. You may have thought it didn't produce. And if you didn't look really close, you can miss them. It's one of those things, too, like, oh, there they are. Like, you're like, there's none on there. And then you're like, okay, wait, no, there's one. And then as soon as you see it, like, your pattern recognition kicks in. You're like, oh, there's another one, there's another one, there's another one, there's another one. They also kind of get thick in layers, and sometimes they'll be underneath. It's really good to grow them on a trellis. That way you can see, like, if you can see both sides of a trellis, like an arch, because you can see the ones from underneath and the ones from up top. And they will grow very vigorously if they have enough time and enough warmth. I've had them 14 foot up into trees before, and you're looking to see little melons way up there. A lot of things like to eat them too, though. So if you don't find them, they'll get eaten. And if you don't find them for a couple of days when they mature, they'll fall off to reproduce themselves. So that's something you got to kind of keep an eye on. The person who can figure out how to grow them in mass quantities, I think you have an incredible product if you sell to restaurants and chefs and things like that, or some kind of like cool niche-y, upscale HOA or something like that. I think they would do really good in. Let's see. Eric says he's going to grow purple sweet potato, and I guess he just means regular purple fleshed sweet potato, or maybe the Okinawans. Those are really good to grow. Artichokes. Bridget says, one of my favorites I tried several years ago, and now I grow them every year. Beautiful plant, too. And she's doing this in Wisconsin. Artichokes are perennial, but can be grown as an annual. I assume that's what she's doing. But Bridget, if you are doing something like cutting them back and then mulching over like people do with figs or something, let me know about that, because I would want to know about that. I have had artichoke overwinter for me here, and I've had winters where it dies. It all depends on how severe the winter is. This year we got one of those events. You know, we get like a week-long event, lots of temperatures down in the teens, days with highs not getting out of the low 20s. That usually knocked them out on me. But then we get other years where, you know, we get some freezes, but the kind of freeze you get is it's 40 degrees during the day. The sun goes down, it hits 28 degrees at night, and it doesn't hit 28 degrees until like 3 o'clock in the morning. And by like 10 a.m. the next day, we're back above freezing. Those types of situations, I never lost any. But anybody that's grown artichokes in more northern climates, if you're getting them to perennialize, I'd love to know how you're doing it, because artichoke is something I really like. I don't grow a lot of it, because without that perennialization, To me, it's a lot of work for how much you get, and I could just go buy them because they're never not around. But if I could grow them reliably, I'd grow more. Jason wants to grow vanilla. Okay, here's my story on vanilla and how I learned I don't want to grow vanilla. Like I said, I wanted to have this huge greenhouse, and I wanted to be the exclusive supplier of coffee and vanilla to a beer brewer in, like, Fort Worth, like, you know, one of these local breweries. And I'm like, I know if I can provide it, I can talk one of them into doing it. Because why? What? And whoever says yes first. And then I was going to get bees, and I had bees. I'm like, we could do a honey, coffee, vanilla, Russian stout. And I'm like, all of it from one farm, except for the malt and everything else, right? And I'm like, I bet you I could even get hops to grow. And I know I can do hops, right? So I could do the hops. I could do and just that one partnership. Like, we'll do this once a year together. I'll sell the cases for you on the air. You won't even have to do any work, right, other than make the product and make a bunch of money on it. And the real hole in the works wasn't coffee. It was vanilla. Vanilla bean grows as a seed pod on a specific variety of orchid. Okay. The orchid will grow for you. This is not a problem. The seed pod will only form if the orchid is pollinated. Most of your vanilla is Madagascar vanilla, and that's because that's where these women that have kind of chubby sausage fingers from the videos I've seen, yet they can still do very intricate work. And these women must have the freaking eyesight of a freaking eagle. And they sit there and they manual, because the little fly that lived there that pollinated these things is gone. It doesn't, no one knows where to find this critter anymore. I think there might be some places in the world where vanilla still naturally pollinates because it's a different fly, but it's this very tiny minuscule fly that has an association with the plant. And basically what's keeping this plant from going extinct now is these women. And I watched him, like, it was like Andrew Zimmerman, but it wasn't him. It was somebody like that, one of these food chefs. And he went over there and tried to learn to do it. And he's sitting there with women that do nothing but this all day, every day. Some of these women have 30 years of experience, and they're trying to teach him to do it. He couldn't do one right. Every time he did one, they were like, nope, not going to work. And I'm like, if it's that much work, I don't want to do it. So it's up to you, Jason, whether you – but the flowers are gorgeous. It's a beautiful white orchid. And the flower itself is just gorgeous and probably worth growing. Then Nathaniel is going to be growing a new tomato variety coming out this year. And it is being released by Gurney's. And I guess it's new, but it's called – if it's not new, it's new-ish. So maybe it's been around a season or two. But it's called Ruby Monster Hybrid Tomato. And it looks just like a great big beefsteak variety of tomato. And I'll bring up a picture of it right there. My gut is that this is a heirloom tomato with maybe a little bit of extra. It says it's an F2, though. So it's an F2 hybrid. I'm just going to say, though, see that R? It's basically, this is not a patented variety. This is a registered trademark name. Usually that means this is actually somebody else's work. Somebody else is the one that developed this plant, but it's been around long enough the patent it expired. And then what will happen is people will take and create a name to market it under. So this kind of looks like Mortgage Lifter to me or something in that space, which has been around forever, and that's why it's no longer under patent. This is like something that began its life in catalogs like either Burpee or Parks. I was trying to say Burks, right? Burpee or Parks. It looks like one of their old beefsteak varieties to me, and that's probably what it is. But that doesn't mean it won't be fantastic. I'm just telling you that's probably where it actually comes from. Then we have passion flower, and I'm not going to bring that up because there's tons of varieties. Some of them will die in a freeze. Some of them will die back to the ground in a light freeze, but the roots will stay good and they'll come back and get bigger as a plant because they're very fast growing. And some like Maypop can grow in like the northeastern United States. Maypop, though, can take an area the hell over. Just know that. But it is Richard who says that. I have a link in the show notes for you on the audio side. There's a link down in the video if you're watching the video. If you're watching me live, it won't work just yet. It will work for you in just a bit when I get off of here and edit and upload it to the audio server. But when you go there, you'll be able to link and find just a huge variety of passion flower, both temperate and tropical climate options from a company called One Green World. And since Rain Tree Nursery changed ownership, this is kind of my go-to for a lot of these really unique varieties of things like sea buckthorn, like gumi, like passion flower and Arctic kiwi and everything. One Green World is a great supplier, Pacific Northwest. And that's kind of the climate that a lot of these plants do better in, but you can definitely grow passion flower in a huge variety of climates as well. James is also going to be growing something called Earth Chestnut. Now, when I first read that, I was thinking maybe it's chufa, which we talked about earlier, or something else that I'm familiar with, but I don't think so. And it is not that supposed bean that's not a bean that we had earlier. I'm going to get the image on the screen for you, though there's not a great picture, honestly, here of it, because it says coming soon. but I'm going to give you the description of it anyway. It's also known as great pignut. It's an edible perennial in the carrot family. It will grow up to 3 feet tall with slender stems topped with white umbral flowers. And it looks very, I'm going to find you a picture of it to actually see it in a bit. It looks very flower, very carrot-like or like fool's parsley-like or something like that. Small, nutty, edible tubers grow under and among the roots. They can be eaten raw, but are best roasted. The flesh leaves are eaten like parsley. Seeds are very flavorful and uses a spice comparable to cumin. That's probably what sold our friend on giving this a try. Let me run a quick web search here for you and get you a picture. I'm using the scientific name to make sure I get the right thing. This is what the flowers on this plant look like right here. And it's like, as you can see, it is very much a carrot-like structure to the plant. This is one of those ones. It's absolutely the case that you are trying something to see how it works out. And I'll just warn you that I have probably tried 300 varieties of weird things. And maybe 1 in 10 works really well and 1 in 5 works at all to actually give me anything from a production standpoint. Totally worth doing. Totally worth doing because I have all these things that are really unique that I grow that you can't buy in a store. And that's how I found every single one of them is by growing, you know, somewhere between 6, 12, some years, even 15 new things every year. And just seeing which ones you throw it all against the wall and what sticks. And it's a lot of fun. That's why I like to do shows like this. This one was really interesting. I have never seen this particular melon before. It is called Haogen, H-A, apostrophe, O-G-E-N. Haogen cantaloupe, and this is an Israeli plant. This comes to us from Rich, and Rich said, I was walking through my neighborhood, and my neighbor gives me this Israeli cantaloupe. This cantaloupe is out of this world. It's so much better than normal cantaloupe. And let me pull this up. And this was not a super easy one to find. It looks more like a honeydew than a cantaloupe to me. And when I get it on the screen here in just a second, you'll see why I say that. It is green fleshed It has an outer rind that looks more like a cantaloupe than a typical honeydew melon, which is usually, the honeydews are usually a smooth green skin. This is more of a netted, you know, cantaloupe-like skin, but it has a green flesh. It's also been called, people call them musk melons, and somebody mentioned that on Facebook in the post, but there's a lot of things called musk melon, and musk melon is really just another name for cantaloupe. So I've never grown this one. This might be one that I'll go ahead and pick up and try this year. If anybody's grown this, I'd love to hear from you and how well it's done for you and in what climate. And then we have the last one is a summer squash that is just an heirloom variety of zucchini, basically. But it is incredibly early. That's kind of its claim to fame, that it's a very early squash. And I'm going to bring it up on the screen as well, but it looks just like a green zucchini, but it is supposed to produce in something like 35 days. The name, which is Inizia, I-N-I-Z-A, that's the name of the variety, supposedly means it begins. It begins. Yeah, you're right. Queen Anne's lace is not, is just wild carrot. I'm thinking of hemlock. Yeah. Hemlock is fool's parsley. It's toxic, right? But they all look like that. So anyway, but this Inizia, so the deal with this being so early is it gets up and produces before the squash vine borers are up and about in a heavy amount. Supposedly, even your female blossoms that have the squash, they're pretty damn big before the flower even opens. But this is an heirloom variety. It is not a hybrid. So you can save seed from it. I am definitely going to try this year because I live in a place, I think if there was any monetary value to squash bugs, squash vine borers, I would produce them here. I would grow things to make them, and I would be rich because this is just ideal habitat for these critters. Now, I'm not going to not give you some of the stuff that I'm going to grow this year, right? So I'm going to go through real quick just the stuff I'm doing this year for the first time. This one is called Paquimi Giant F1 Hybrid Jalapeno Peppers. I grow my own peppers every year. I have saved seed from them year after year after year after year, and they produce a ton of peppers, and they tend to turn red more than your typical jalapeno. Now they actually, my line started with a very famous old open pollinated heirloom called Jalapeno M, but I've been growing them for 25 years. So they really have their own thing going on. But one thing I really, really like is big peppers, big jalapenos. My jalapeno M's that I selected specifically for the trait of turning red, thick wall, and size get pretty big. Also get a lot of small ones on them. But a really big one will be maybe 3 inches stem to tip. So not huge, but a good size jalapeno for cheese and bacon wrapping and putting on the grill. These things get like 5 inches. These things are like a small freaking, you know, like hatch pepper almost in size, right? I mean, these are big, but the big thick walls of a jalapeno, and they're about average jalapeno strength as far as heat. So I thought that would be a good one to try and maybe broaden out my jalapeno game a little bit because I do like jalapenos. And I've actually never had a jalapeno I don't like. I'm also growing Slangen Italian cucumber this year. And I found those from the NE Seed. By the way, they were a MSB supplier. They did a discount. They changed ownership. I helped the old owner as best I could on his way out with a big sale we posted about. The new ownership has no interest in even talking to us. So I'm not going to not buy from them because they're a good supplier and they have some really great stuff. but I can't get you guys a discount there anymore. So I'm starting to work on finding another seed company since we lost that one to get you guys discounts for. But we have a bunch of great companies we do business with, you know, Victory Seeds, High Mowing, and some others. You can always check your MSB account for that. But this is also known as Shintoquia cucumber. So this is actually, again, an Asian cucumber variety. I, like one of our earlier folks, have grown China Jade a lot. I wanted to give this one a try. This seems like it's got some really interesting things going for it. This is a medium green cucumber, tender, crisp flesh, few seeds, grows up to 12 inches long without getting, you know, bitter and what have you. That's what I really like about Asian style cucumbers. You can get really big fruits on them without them getting bitter and fibrous, because I don't like things to get fibrous like that as well. On my tomatoes, I said I have all my tomatoes picked out for this year, but I do have a couple new ones I'm trying, which is why I'm not going to try that other one. This one is from Baker Creek, and I believe it is new for this season with them, so it's new even for them, and it's called Rosella, R-O-S-E-L-L-A, and this just looks like a fantastic freaking tomato for our climate and the things that we deal with here. Massive trusses of dark rose to purple cherries with smoky blush. Tiny cherries are a half inch across and contain very few seeds, superb for fresh eating, solid enough for cooking and making deep, rich, red tomato paste. Superior balance between sweetness and acidity. Lingering aftertaste. Crazy about, they say, you know, that's their, now they've gone into their marketing. But this looks like a very crack-resistant tomato. That's something else I deal with a lot here, is my tomatoes will, just before they really start to get ripe, crack on me. And this has a lot of resistance to that. And it just looks like a beautiful tomato. And, you know, I deal with tomato blight every year. As I've improved my soil, that is less and less the case. And I just keep trying new varieties, because tomatoes are one of the things I like to try new varieties of. Then I also have a new eggplant. Now, my go-to eggplant has become Ping Tong. This is called Niranjan, I guess. This is an Indian variety. And this was specifically cultivated by one person. His name is Lealarm Shahu in Dhamtari, a small village in something I can't pronounce, India. And he's been working with this in his family for a very, very long time. And that's what I like about Beggar Creek. They tend to go out and find these things. This is a long variety eggplant, similar to Ping Tong, but it has this gorgeous stripe pattern on it. It's also an open pollinated variety, not a hybrid. He's just worked with this one variety to make it his own, so to say. So unlike the Ping Tong, if this works out, it'll be great for saving seeds without having to go through seven, you know, generations of proving it out. So I'm going to be growing that this year as well. And last but not least, another tomato. And this one just sounded cool. I'll be honest, it just sounded cool. And it also has some of the things that I'm looking for in a tomato. One of those is I grow almost all exclusively small variety and cherry tomatoes. I just get better results with them, and I get a lot more production that way. And we don't do like a canning a bunch of tomato sauce or something like that. So if I did get heavy production from larger species, I would have more tomato than I really need in a given season. These are more of a snack, more for making pico and salsas and bruschettas and stuff like that in the summertime, because we eat a lot of that. But this plant is called Purple Bumblebee. And it's not that purple if you're looking at the picture of it anyway. It's got like purple flecks in it and inside of it. And let me read you the description on it, though. Slightly elongated little cherries with the most outrageous striping in lime green and bronzy purple. Crack resistant. Again, that's something I'm always looking for. Fruit is produced all season long. This was my big one. Unfazed by temperature extremes. The flavor is complex but sweet. Excellent holding quality makes this new type outstanding for the market. The bar for quality has got higher from artisan seeds. So I think this is going to do really well in my climate. This is what I was looking for from the Everglades tomato that we talked about earlier, but that Everglades tomato is really bred for humidity because it is a Florida thing. And that's what it's adapted to. It's adapted to the swamp. Now, I have swamp-like weather in April, some years. Some years even in a little bit into May. By June, it's a friggin' desert. It's dry, and it's hot. And this should do better there. So those are the things I'm growing. I'd love to hear I had to read this from Lee Murphy. I love Lee. She says, Baker Creek's photography is well into the PSYOP territory. Each photo is swoon-worthy such that I want one of everything. Yeah, I call him the crack dealer, right? Like, how many seed companies are there that you can order? Like, you have to buy their seed catalog now, their big, thick one, because they know everybody does this. But you can buy a seed company seed catalog and throw it on your coffee table like a coffee table book, and people will come to your house that don't care anything about a garden, and they'll pick it up and like, ooh, ah, wow, oh. And if you are a gardener, you're like, I need this and that and this and that and this and that. Yeah, that's why I said, I think I even have done shows where I literally have in the title called them my dealer or my crack dealer, my seed crack dealer. And they're not the only operation. I don't want to get that wrong. And they're not the most affordable. And their quality is great. But so is 100 other small seed houses. I'm going to say, though, that in that space, Baker Creek isn't a competitor. It's an amplifier. And what I mean by that is they make so many people aware of so many things that they would never know about. And when those people become interested in those things, they decide they want to become interested in other things. And so they start looking more. And when they look more, they don't just find Baker Creek, they find other companies. And I guarantee you a lot of these other companies are buying initial seed stock from Baker Creek, because Baker Creek is sending people all over the country and all over the world to find these new varieties. Like, some of the stuff in the Baker Creek catalog you'll read, it'll be like, you know, we were in India at a farmer's market, which has to be amazing in India, right? A farmer's market in India. And we found this one particular variety of whatever. And we brought it home and we planted it. And, you know, you brought seeds home and planted it. It did really good and all. And how much of that's marketing and how much of that's real, I don't know. But I'm going to say, I think that it legit is kind of their overall. I think Jerry Gettle does love the fact that he gets to travel the world looking for interesting varieties of things and then get them into the country one way or another and then make them known. And so when something like Python Snake Bean comes out, I guarantee you there are smaller seed houses. They're like, oh, that seems cool. They buy some, they try it, they're like, yeah. And then maybe they grow it for a few seasons, and now they have a new seed variety to add to their catalog. And I love that Baker Creek kind of provides that. I've only got 4 questions or comments started, but this was complex. I have this sheets of paper today that I'm reading from. That's why maybe my timing sounded a little off. So if I missed you right now, you can go ahead and put question in all caps. And I will come back and check one more time after I go through here. And the last question I have is from A.Evans. I am starring you right now, bro. Anybody after this question right here, if you don't hear your question, you better redo it. So I got about 6 now. So let's start off. Keith Wookman says, can someone help me, or this might be for Jack, anyone have updates on Jack's Mr. Miyagi pond? I bought a house, and I'm looking at putting something like it in, or his pond class course. Okay, I don't have an aquatics course coming anytime soon. That was something I was going to do. I can only do so many things, and that was such a big can of worms. I kind of stuck a fork in it for a while, and I don't know if it's done or not, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. There's tons of videos of my Miyagi ponds, and it's really not hard to figure out what to do. It's a box made out of 4x4s and lag screws with a pond liner dropped into it. I want to say something probably for the 500th time, though, that I really need people to understand. The way I built mine is not ideal, and I do not recommend you build one like mine. Okay? Mine are about 40 inches high to the rail, and the water, therefore, is coming up to about 36 to 37 inches of wall that is not reinforced by anything other than wood and lag screws. All right? Structural wood screws, I guess is what they're called. It's what you replace a lag bolt with now when you do decking, okay? And they have worked fine, but the biggest one has some good bulging in it, and I don't know how long it's going to last. It could last another 10 years. It could last 15 years. It could last 2 years. I don't know. And when you build any water feature that high up, if you want to pitch water with a pump somewhere and return it, you want your pond, your sump, as low as possible, not high. The only reason I built them that way is I can only dig about 10 inches into the ground. If I could dig 4 feet into the ground, I would have dug a 4 foot deep square. And if I wanted the look of a Miyagi, I would have brought the timber component above grade about at most 2 feet high, which would bring the water level up to about 18 inches above grade or thereabouts. That would have very little pressure on the wood from the water. You're talking about in a 12 by 12 like I have, about 5,800 gallons, and the pressure curve peak is dead center, which is where the bulging is. So there's actually, like, at the very bottom, there's less pressure on the outside. As you come up to about halfway, you maximize the pressure, and then the pressure goes down. It's like a bell curve from top to bottom, with the greatest pressure about 50% of the way up. Don't do it unless you have to. Put your pond in the ground. Again, if you like the look, and I do think the look is beautiful, then go deep and bring it up to something about like they would be comfortable to sit on the rail of. And if you do that, you know, if you're 4 feet below ground and 2 feet above ground, your center where your maximum amount of outward pressure is going to be about 2 feet in the ground. You know, 1.5 to 2 feet is going to where you're, and so then you got the whole Mother Earth holding the pond, and you don't need wood down there. It's much less expensive to do that. Everything I did was to adapt to the situation, and it's not ideal. Please know that, Keith. But if you want to find more about them, put timber frame pond in YouTube search, and you'll find a lot of my videos, or go to my channel and look for my aquatics playlist as well. You can find, I've basically given away everything for free already. And if you want to see what I mean about going in the ground and staying low, look at my duck house pond, timber frame pond project. Go look that one up. And that's not as deep as I would like, but it's much more structurally built the way I would recommend you do this, wherever you can dig a freaking hole. Second Light Farm says, have you ever tried growing the giant yellow jalapeno? Johnny has them available. They get about 4 inches long, absolutely sweet and delicious, about as hot as a regular jalapeno, but sweeter. I've not done those. I have grown a pepper called mariachi. They get just like that, exactly like that, except they're not all yellow. Some of them are yellow. Some of them are red. Some of them are. You get multiple colors on the same plant. They are not hot at all unless you eat the seeds. And the seeds are very hot in those, but I haven't tried those at all. I like red jalapenos. To me, a good jalapeno left to the point where it turns red on the plant is perfect. The heat fully matures and then drops as the pepper fruit itself sweetens as it goes into the red. So you still got a lot of heat, but you got a lot more flavor in a red one than a green one, in my humble opinion. Question for the crowd. Anyone in PA know where to find Maypop? I'll leave that for you guys to discuss among yourselves because I do not. I grew up in Pennsylvania, but I have to admit that when I was a teenager growing up in Pennsylvania, I didn't know what Maypop was yet. That was not something that my family worked with. Question from 229 Mick. Any recommendation on what to grow for chickens? Does anybody sell a package of things for chickens like Nick does with fodder trees? I will tell you, Mick, that there is an episode where I specifically talk about growing things for chickens. And it's things like sorghum and a lot of things we talked about today as well in there. I don't remember what it's called, and I can't start hunting for it for you right now. You can look it up yourself. Use the search box. You might have to try a bunch of different queries. If you can't find it, email me, because I'm not going to remember. Okay, I'm just going to tell you right now, when I go to do all my editing and stuff for this show, it's going to go completely out of my mind and I'm going to forget about it. But if you email me, I can find it and I will find it for you and I will send you back a link for it if you need that. Andy says, response. Okay, I don't know who's responding to, but response in all caps. So I got it starred. Upstate New York, I have 3-year-old pomegranate in a pot, southern figs, and just started avocado all in pots. Okay, so he's probably responding to me asking about avocados. My big issue with avocado is, can you grow it large enough in a container where it's big enough to produce and still manageable enough to move in and out of a home? With any level of production that in any way makes it worth the effort. Because everybody's done the get an avocado pit to sprout and grow a houseplant thing. But growing one that actually makes avocados, that's what I'd like to know more about if anybody's pulled it off. A. Evan says, do you have a chainsaw recommendation? Depends. It depends. If you're buying a gas-powered saw, get a steel or a McCullough. I'm done. That's my recommendation. If you want an electric saw, Oregon probably makes the best overall electric chainsaws, and they have integrated built-in sharpening. They have limitations, but they have a plug-in one that's stupid cheap and a battery one that the real expense is the battery. They use a specific kind of chain that works with a sharpening stone that you also replace when you replace the chain. It goes under your cover plate. And when you are using the saw and you want to sharpen the chain, you literally pull a little lever and run the chain for about 2 seconds. And it goes back to super sharp cutting. And I love those saws. If you are on the DeWalt tool set, though, and I imagine Rigid and, Bosch and other companies maybe are in this game now, too. I don't know. But DeWalt makes a little like 12-inch bar chainsaw that uses the standard DeWalt freaking 20 volt batteries. It is a freaking hoss. It is limited by the length of the bar, obviously. Okay. And when it doesn't have the fancy little auto sharpen, but it is twice the tool of the Oregon in power. It is an incredible little saw. And if you buy it as a bare tool, it's not very expensive. It's not cheap, but it's not very expensive. And it would definitely be something to watch the Amazon Renewed store for. Remember, you can always shop Amazon on my website at tspaz.com. Get all my recommendations, and no matter what you buy, you help us out. But you also find information there about different Amazon programs and what they really are. The Renewed program is not something broke and then somebody sent it to Amazon under warranty and they fix it and sell it to you. It is simply returns that they cannot sell as new. Because somebody ordered it and realized they ordered two and sends one back. Because somebody ordered it and their wife goes, yeah, I really need that. And they sent it back. Because they ordered it and they realized on their own they didn't really need it and they sent it back. Because they got a pay cut. Because they lost their job. For whatever reason, they never used it and they sent it back. Okay? And then they can't sell it as new, so they put it in the Renewed store and they sell it. Amazon used to do this with all their returns. They just put them on big pallets. They put wrapper around them. They estimated the retail value and they sold it to the public who would go through it and then market it often right back on Amazon. Okay. And they pretty much did it with everything. But Amazon's a data driven company. So they figured out really quick, you know, when we do that and stuff on that pallet is like a KitchenAid stand mixer, a Cuisinart food processor, a DeWalt tool, a Bosch tool, right? These top, a Ninja, right? Top end kitchen brands, power tool brands, you know, audio, video brands, stuff like that. Those were the stuff that when people put it back on Amazon to sell it, used it sold really fast. So now they put all the dog shit on those pallets that they still sell to those people. And they take that top end gear that simply needs to be put back in a box and reshipped out and they sell it as Renewed. There is nobody with a soldering iron fixing a fucking Cuisinart food processor at an Amazon building. That is not a thing. It would not happen. It's not going to happen. No one does that. It's the products are not designed to be repaired. That's all that it is fast returns on unused items. And it comes with a 60-day warranty. So definitely consider checking that out, too, if you want a battery-powered chainsaw. Which, by the way, I love battery-powered saws. They have different purposes. I have a Steel Farm Boss. If I have to do real heavy-duty work, that's what I go to. When I just need to, like, take a few limbs off or knock this one tree down or prune this one thing off, I go to one of my battery-powered saws. They're lighter, instant on-demand power, quieter, faster, just fantastic. Firebird Optics, $20 super chat. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that on a Monday. A little gas money close there. Great. Thank you. It was 30 degrees below with wind chill the other night. This episode has been like pornography. I think he means pornography, but he spelled it pornography so it wouldn't get censored. I do my part, man. I do my part. And yeah, it is. And I'm getting to the point now where like I need to get shit done, right? Like I did order some stuff from Baker Creek a couple weeks ago and it's not here yet. I emailed them today like, guys, where's my shit, right? Where's my shit? Like I need it. I need to get it started. I've got a really cool new seed starting system going on in the garage. And I just bought some humidity and temperature gauges to compare it to the garage itself without it being in that system. And I think it's going to be pretty cool. I'll be making those sensors available to you guys as well. Super low tech. They have one button on them. You can change it from Fahrenheit to centigrade. You put the batteries in, they're on. But it gives you humidity and it gives you temperature. But this is really cool. That one button, if you push it and hold it, it resets everything to zero from the record keeping it does, where it tells you the highest and lowest temperature and highest and lowest humidity since the last time you reset it. So I think that's going to give us a lot of information about this aquaponics fish tank thing that I've created for seed starting this year that I think a lot of you guys are really going to like. James White. Hey, James, how you doing, man? Holiday avocado might be a good one to try. Description, shortest tree known, firm flesh with a salted butter flavor, great for espalier. Okay, might be something to check out then. Again, it's called Holiday avocado variety. I got two more and then we're going to wrap up. Jesse says, I have an Asian store in town that's willing to buy all the Chinese eggplant and Chinese bitter melon I can grow. Bitter melon's another great crop. I'm going to tell you, if you're going to grow for market, if you have any kind of a heavy ethnic market in your area, find out what those people like. I have seen this time and time again. If we have a surplus of duck eggs, which very seldom happens, all Dorothy has to do is go get her nails done. They're all Chinese and Vietnamese at the nail salon. She can walk in there and go have duck eggs in the car. And if the girls there don't directly want them all, they're on their cell phones, and in 5 minutes, they're like, we take them all. And then they always try to haggle. How much? $10 a dozen. Oh, no, we buy all. Yet for $10 a dozen. But we'll buy all. Yes, for $10 a dozen. About three of those, and they're like, okay, right? I told her, just tell them 12 so you can give them a deal at 10, right? But she's not real comfortable doing it. What if they give me 12? I'm like, then take their money and smile. Because they're already getting a discount because that's all new customers right now pay 12 a dozen. Eric says, on tree forage, do you discourage using other mulberry varieties other than white mulberry as fodder? It's not so much I discourage it. What you want in a fodder tree is what we call palatability. Not that it won't kill an animal, but that the animal wants to eat it. And the white mulberry has been cultivated, and there's white mulberry isn't a tree. It's a variety, a family of mulberry. There's hundreds of trees in that world of white Morris alba versus Morris whatever the red one, and there's a black one too. Morris nigra, and then there's Morris, I don't remember the red one. probably Rosa or something like that, right? But Morris Alba is the white mulberry. And that group of trees is what the Chinese bred specifically to grow silkworms for the silk trade. And so it has thousands of years of work that has been done by selecting it specifically to be palatable to silkworms. And it turns out that that which is palatable to a silkworm is tends to also be very palatable to a ruminant or something like a rabbit, which is actually a little ruminant, right? So rabbits aren't ruminants, are they? They sure poop like a ruminant. So I never thought about that. Is a rabbit a little ruminant? Or is it just a rabbit? Is it just a rodent? I think it's a rodent, not a ruminant. Anyway, I've never seen rabbits chew cud, so I guess that's not the case either. But rabbits and ruminants tend to really like the leaf of the white mulberry. So it's not that there's not other mulberries that might work. There's a lot of trees that'll work, but how hungry does the animal have to be to eat it? So for instance, hackberry is a great fodder tree. Lots of things will eat it. It's not as, and it's the whole hack thing, like it, you know, make you sick or whatever. It's not the case. But like my geese, when they were young, if you pulled a branch off a hackberry tree, they just ate the shit out of it. As they got older, they're not really interested in it. But, you know, come fall, they'll eat all of the tips off of the weeping willows, right? They'll eat everything they can reach at that point. So they like the willow and the mulberry as well, more than they like the hackberry. So it's just more palatable, I guess. Anyway, guys, I appreciate you guys tuning in today. Want to remind you guys, if you want to help us out, there's a couple ways to do that. And one of those ways is pick up a copy of my book, if you haven't done so yet, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. You can get your copy of this book. And if you have one for yourself, consider getting a copy as a gift for someone else. It is available in soft cover, as a Kindle ebook, and as an audiobook. I will tell you, the audiobook is AI read. And I think it's pretty good for what it is. But it is AI read, so some of the words are pronounced not exactly perfectly and what have you. The only reason I put it out is Kindle KDP made it soon after. Everybody wanted audio, and I'm like, I don't have time to make an audiobook for you. Kindle KDP, their self-publishing platform, like 2 days after my book went live, push this button and make an audiobook. All right, it works. So that's how the audiobook came to be there. And then I've got my item of the day. I mentioned T-Spaz earlier. When you go to tspaz.com, you can find that right on my website. You can find all the things that I've recommended over the years and all the things that I use in my own life. And you can get over to Amazon and pick them up if you want to. But there's also links there that you can use to just get on over there. And no matter what you buy, you will help us out. So it's a very painless way when you're going to shop online. Start at T-Spaz. But today's item of the day are adjustable grow light rope hangers. These are made by a company called Zazzy. But I would tell you, is if you're shopping for them and you need more than the 12 that come with this, if you find like a quantity buy and they look exactly like this, get them from anybody. They're not a super high quality thing. All they do is hold plant lights up in the air, or they're good for some other things like water bottles for chickens and things like that with the chicken nipples on them. I've had a bunch of different things people tell me they use them for where they can easily adjust the height. But they're great. And what they allow you to do is by just reaching in and grabbing the tab and pulling the string, you can adjust your light height from your plants up and down. Why would you want to do that? Because even really good plant light should be pretty close to the plant. Of course, as the plant, so when you first put your seed in, you want them only a few inches above the top of the soil. But as that plant starts growing, you want to move those lights up so the plants don't get up into the light. This just makes it really easy to do that. I talk about it in the write-up, but I want to tell you one thing about this here before we close up today. You see how it has these two little clip carabiners? Okay, the problem with that is depending on how high your top shelf is from your next shelf down, that reduces how high you can lift the lights up. So I've had them in some systems where what ends up happening is before I'm ready to move that plant out to the garden, that plant is up into the lights and I can't get it any higher. if you take that carabiner off on the top side where the string is, not where the clip is, you can just directly tie it, and that'll give you like another 2 inches of rise that you'll get out of that. So that's something you can look at and still use them. And of course, you know, those snap-on carabiners, they have a use whether you leave them on there or not. They're not super, again, they're not, I wouldn't go rappelling with this shit, right? It's not designed for that, but they're fantastic. And they were also, the year that I brought them out, they were one of the top selling items for that year. I think they were like the number 8th highest selling by units of anything I sold. And I think 2021 when I brought them out, never had a complaint. No one's ever bitched about them. And they're not expensive. You get 12 sets for like $20. So yeah, or $18, right? 6 sets for $18. So 12 for $18. So like $1.40 a piece. And they just make your life so much better. Now, somebody today, when I posted them, I was Societus, right? In the alumni group, said there is, and he gave a link to it on Thingiverse. If you have a 3D printer, people have actually made light fixtures for the Barina lights so that you could have like an array of like 6 lights, but only use 2 of those, you know, kind of brought together with like a triangle, and then 2 of them to move the whole array up and down instead of like 2 per light. That's pretty cool. And so if you're a 3D printer person, you might want to check that out. And that gave me an idea I wanted to drop on you here at the end too. There is a lot of people trying to find their little side hustle. And if you find a product like Barina that sells like crazy, that means there's a pretty good market out there. And there are people that just don't want to fuck with 3D printing. They know about it. It's cool and all. They don't want to fuck with it. Hi, I'm one of them. I'm Jack, and I don't want a 3D print anymore. And because of that, and there's people making money doing 3D printing. Most of them are doing like little tchotchkes and things like that. Now, some people are actually making really functional things. That would be the example of a really functional thing. So what you might want to do if you're in that world of looking for a side hustle and you don't want it to be, I don't know if you make a full-time business out of it, right? But if it's an add-on revenue stream or something like that to a full-time business would work as well. Find things that you can build something to make better that isn't really worth it to the manufacturer for them to do it. That's where 3D printing is, where like the cost of setup and mold making and all that shit is just too high for the volume, but there's enough volume there to still make money. Because I'll tell you something, that's what you really need if you're going to build a business, because companies will fuck you. You would think a company would look at that and go, oh, okay, yeah, they're making some money. And they probably will there because the cost exceeds the value. But I want to just give you one of my, you know, Google do no harm, no evil stories of a company that does harm and evil to like single moms and shit, right? Or, you know, homestead moms and what have you. Because Google's done a lot of nasty shit like that in their past. And whoever makes Skittles, I don't know if it's, you know, Hershey or M&M Mars or whoever makes Skittles, you're a bunch of pricks. So there's been this thing going on for a very long time that people would get a Harvest-Rite freeze dryer or another brand, and then they would make freeze-dried Skittles and sell them like on eBay and Etsy and what have you. And they would kind of do that until they made enough money to pay for their machine, and then they kind of backed away and did other things. And it was like a completely unwritten rule. No one enforced it or whatever, but there was a lot of people doing that. And you could tell because you would see people come into Etsy, start selling that candy, and then that would kind of disappear. Like, I got mine, so I'm going to get out of the way and let Susan get hers. That type of thing. Fucking Skittles now sells freeze-dried Skittles. It was like they looked at it. And you're like, this has to be a tiny market segment for a company that size. They couldn't freaking stand it. Now, the person that they're putting out of business is probably buying Skittles by the pallet from them, but they couldn't stand to see somebody else making the money. So if you're going to go into those niche side hustles, try to find the things that are very so niche that the corporation itself that you're augmenting is like, I don't have it in me. It's not worth it. But yet big enough to get you enough volume to make it worth doing. Just a little extra side note for today. Okay. With that, we're going to go ahead, wrap up. 2 hours and 35 minutes, way longer than I planned on today. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. Time to get out and get planning, because spring is going to spring before you know it. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with another one. And then we got a great interview this week on Wednesday. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way, others will follow. Revolution.